I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Conference Committee to order. Today is May 10th, 2022. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Representative Wasilek.
Wasilek present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Lippert.
Present.
Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Present.
Senator Tomasoni. Senator Tomasoni. Senator Eichhorn. Senator Eichhorn. Senator Weber. Senator Weber. And Senator Eakin. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just note the senators that were not here will be there shortly. One has got a bill on the floor. However, we're going to proceed as we normally would be here. They're going to find a place and continue to vote remotely. So they should be here shortly. But if you want to go ahead, I'm not sure what your agenda is.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. And we will proceed. When we finished yesterday, there was a discussion about having Met Council, and they were unable to be here today. Okay. But we do have Explore Minnesota Tourism, and then also we had some members wanted to go back to PCA on a couple of issues. So we have Laura Bennett McGinty here from Explore Minnesota Tourism.
Thank you so much, Chair Hansen, and thank you to all of the senators and representatives today for allowing us to speak. So I wanted to kind of start out by saying, you know, Explore Minnesota Tourism strongly supports the budget proposals that are in this omnibus version. With the funding, we can support the industry in a variety of ways, and it's needed now more than ever. As I've traveled the state and spoken with multiple destination marketing organizations and chambers of commerce, it's clear that they too support this funding. In fact, I was in Grand Rapids yesterday and they brought it up and are in full support. $10 million could have a strong impact on every city in the state. Not only could tourism-related businesses get back to where they once were, but we could also see these businesses use money to attract visitors to help boost the local economy. Tourism touches almost every aspect of a town or city. Whether you're a hotel or restaurant, brewery or museum, the pandemic has severely impacted your business. If Explore Minnesota receives this funding, we can provide grants to more businesses than we ever have before. Additionally, the increase of $215,000 to the base budget could support this work. We did not receive any ARPA funding and we were awarded only $4 million through the EDA, which we're using all on outside of Minnesota marketing to attract new visitors and new money to the state of Minnesota. That means that we are, however, currently competing and falling behind our regional neighbors, including North Dakota, South Dakota, Michigan, and Wisconsin, as they receive tens of million dollars in EDA and ARPA funding, and in the case of Wisconsin, more than $100 million to market their state. Though $215,000 might not seem impactful, it would allow us to hire additional staff to support marketing and PR efforts. And earned media is one of the best ways to get the word out about Minnesota. And it doesn't cost as much as paid media, obviously. And having more staff to be able to support that effort and bring in new pitches about Minnesota and new articles or television appearances could be incredibly cost effective for us to be competitive with our neighbors. I am certainly available for any questions and would be happy to provide more information as needed.
Thank you. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question for Ms. Bennett McGinty. I'm excited about this proposal in the House bill being in Northfield has a big festival, the Feet of Jesse James Days. We see people come in from all over the region, and it seems like these funds would be a great way to support communities and festivals like this across the state. But I'm curious if you can say more about the entities and organizations that would be eligible for these grants and some examples of community events that could be supported.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. So that's a great question. I think, you know, right now, given that this is such a large pot of money, we have actually had internal conversations about how we can expand it even more than we've done before. Traditionally, the marketing grants that we've given out have been specifically for places to primarily market their towns to outside visitors, and they can certainly use that to market events if they wish. However, you know, given that this is a larger pot, we do anticipate that marketing events and festivals would be an option. We also, of course, would work with tribal nations as well as destination marketing organizations and chambers of commerce to find ways to allow them to market more of what they're doing outside of the sort of more traditional marketing grants that we've done. For example, this year alone, we gave away $1 million in marketing grants, and that would be a one-to-one match. So I think there's also opportunity here to possibly allow grants without a match necessarily. Again, that's something that we would certainly discuss and talk about feasibility for. But this is kind of new territory for us. We're certainly excited to take it on and are more than willing to work with grants management at the government to kind of determine what the best policies are.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was really helpful. And I'm curious if you have any just general rule of thumb, if there are correlations between these sorts of dollars and these sorts of grants and how they can help the people who shop and eat and stay in communities. Is there any rule of thumb that you have as far as how these grants can help communities with those direct people and dollars spent in communities?
Director Bennett McGinty.
Thank you. I don't have the exact numbers right off the top of my head. I certainly am more than willing to talk to our grants management team and get that information for you. I will say that traditionally in our matching grants program, businesses and DMOs have been able to do, say, something like $15,000, and then we would match that. So they're stretching their dollar by two, which automatically gives them a little bit more spending power out in the market to attract more people than they had before.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you for that response. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final comment. I mean, I think those small businesses that really rely on tourism across the state are still recovering, and I think these sorts of grants will go directly to communities across the state. I think it's a good way to use these resources rather than, you know, funding kind of one big event or two big events. I think we can get multiple events and lots of support scattered throughout the state that would really help small communities in every corner of the state. So thank you, Ms. McGinty, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually have two questions. And it's been a while since we've had a chance to visit with Explore Minnesota Tourism, so I'm going to just go ahead and dive right in. Maybe you could shed a little bit of light on as to what happened to the governor's fishing opener. I saw newspaper stories suggesting that it was an issue with communities not having resources. So it'd be nice to know if that was a part of what you understand to be the issue with the governor's fishing opener not happening, at least in the traditional sense this year. And then also, if maybe dollars were an issue, would Explore Minnesota Tourism be potentially supportive of an earmark in funding to help those small communities if cost was, as the story suggested, part of the issue getting a Minnesota governor's fishing opener going this year?
Director McGinty.
Thank you for the question. So traditionally, the governor's fishing opener requires a community to gather funds to be able to put it on. We put out an RFP annually, and unfortunately, due to COVID, that process has changed significantly over the past 2 years. However, we are actually live this week with the new RFP for 2023. So we're kind of going back to what we were doing previously. But I will say that from what we understand, communities have tended to raise approximately $80,000 to $100,000 to support the efforts of this program. We at Explore Minnesota have also traditionally given a $10,000 grant to support kind of the media efforts and the public relations efforts of the fishing opener. And I will say that, you know, we are excited. It's actually this upcoming weekend. I'm sure we're all aware and I'm sure we all have plans. But we are, you know, able to do more than we thought we were going to be able to do. I think, you know, just in the planning of this particular event, and certainly some of it was done before I came aboard. But we were just unsure what COVID would bring. And so we were able to bring in some of those more traditional elements as the pandemic started to kind of fade a little bit more. And we were able to bring it to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And they are being an incredible community support for us. So we are really thankful to all of the collaboration we've been able to do in the past few months here to get ready.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll try again. Would Explore Minnesota Tourism be favorable to an earmark for these small communities? You mentioned the $80,000 to $100,000 that was cited in the newspaper stories. I saw that too. I'm wondering if we need to do something more, because it sounds like that was an obstacle, at least that was mentioned by the governor's office, I think, as an obstacle to this governor's fishing opener being held in the traditional sense. So I'm wondering if Explore Minnesota would support an earmark, and you didn't really say one way or the other. So maybe if I give you a second chance.
Director Bennett McGinty.
My apologies. I forgot that part of the question, part two. You know, I think we have had that discussion internally, and I think we certainly could have more just knowing, you know, how that money could be used. I think certain stipulations around that would be really helpful. And I also think, you know, just kind of feeling out what communities are still interested in doing. From what I understand, regardless of money, it's also a very heavy lift for volunteers and kind of facilities. And there are only so many communities in the state that can handle the number of people that come. So I think, you know, we're open to having a discussion about what funding might look like in the future.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just thinking about what is currently in House language and Senate language in this conference committee being discussed today, is there anything in the Senate language or in the House language that could work towards that conversation, as you suggested, that could be happening or that would support the governor's fishing opener for these small communities that are having a hard time trying to come up with $80,000 to $100,000? Is there anything in the bills that you've maybe seen that we should be watching, or is there something that we need to do more so that could potentially come in an amendment or part of the discussions and negotiations as we're moving this conference committee forward?
Director Bennett McGinty.
So, I mean, I think certainly the $10 million for recovery for the tourism industry is of the utmost importance. It's a priority, certainly, for us bringing money into the state and bringing travelers. That will only help boost the economy. So I think in addition to that, if there is conversation or if you'd like to have a conversation about funding to support the fishing opener, we are certainly open to those conversations. And I would also say that including folks at the DNR and governor's office would also be helpful, given that it is kind of this event that we put on among the three groups. So I would hate to cut them out of the conversation, because of course the DNR is a huge part of it as well.
Mr. Chair, just a following up comment, if it's all right.
I thought you were going to ask about the pheasant opener and the deer opener too, but go ahead.
No, you'd be mistaken, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to talk about any of those things. I was just going to point out that it doesn't appear that we know one way or the other if any of the proposed language from either the House or Senate would potentially help with the governor's fishing opener. So I'd be one member of this conference committee willing to bring that forward. I do have a bill for that, although if it isn't something that can move forward currently, I'll certainly be working on it going forward. I think there might be some chances at the moment, but I see Senator Ingebrigtsen waving his hands. I'll digress.
Representative Heinzman, are you done then?
Yep. Okay. Representative Wazowicz was up. Well, she was up before I was. I don't have a button, so help me.
Representative Wazowicz, Then we'll go to you, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for Ms. Bennett-McGinty. So I know that the legislature provided $750,000 for recovery grants, and I'm wondering if you can talk about, if you have these numbers, how many recipients there were of those grants, and then how many grant applications there were that weren't funded because you didn't have enough money, and like maybe if you know the total amount of money that the that those grant applications that were not funding, like what sort of amount of funding were they looking for?
Director Bennett-McGinty.
Thank you. Yes, that's a great question. I do know that the grant, actually, the money was gone in 8 hours. That's how quickly it ran out. I apologize. I think something's amiss with my video. Sorry, my apologies. Okay, there we go. I'm sorry, I am on location in Duluth, so you never know what'll happen. So that money ran out in 8 hours. We were able to support 130 communities around the state with that. I know some of my team is on. Mike, I know you're on. Would you be willing to talk about kind of that process? I was just not on board at the time, so I know that he was more involved with it. So I would ask that Michael Meyer be able to speak to the numbers.
Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Michael Meyer, Business Operations Manager. Unfortunately, Lauren, I don't have those numbers specifically, but I could probably reach out and get those in a few minutes.
That would be great. Sorry about that, everyone. But so anyway, I do know that it went very quickly. And certainly as I travel around the state, I have heard from every single place that I've been that they are looking for more dollars to kind of get them off the ground. So I do know that the need is great. And I know that this committee, as well as the Senate committee, has heard from folks at the Community of Minnesota Resorts, the Minnesota Tourism Growth Coalition, the MACVB, in addition to various DMOs and chambers of commerce about how important this would be for them.
Representative Wazlik, another question, or should we wait until they come back with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I would love to get that information. I think it's important that we have an understanding of, like, we did give a little money, but it wasn't enough, and the need to continue the program. So thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I now have a hand raised button here working. Thank you, Director, for the information. I'm checking to see what was in the budget for last year. Maybe you have that at hand, but my staff is looking that up right now. But I want to go directly to the large events portion of the Senate bill. I understand that you or someone in your office is in contact with Senator Rosen with regards to this bill.
Director McGinty.
Yes. We did reach out to her to request a meeting. The conversation was around specifically the lottery and lieu funding. And then I also requested from the Minnesota Sports and Events Group as well. You know, Senator Rosen had actually indicated that she would kind of help facilitate that. A strategic plan for bringing these events to greater Minnesota. I know it is written in the bill that 50% of that funding would go to support bringing events in and promoting events in greater Minnesota. To date, however, we have not seen any sort of strategic planning around that. I think given that that group is so new, they have kind of stuck to those like larger marquee events, like the Super Bowl and the Final Four. So we are kind of interested to know how, as Explore Minnesota, if we are helping facilitate that grant, how we might be able to do that on a larger statewide scale, given that that is kind of our role and responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for that. And Representative Heintzman was talking about a very large event, which is the governor's opener, as well as now we have an event coming, a special needs event, athletic event, I believe, state event, I believe, coming to the Twin Cities area. And so I'm kind of excited about this. I myself, and I think mostly everybody that knows what this is about, understands that large events come to either the metro or rural And of course, they spend a lot of money, and a lot of money means sales tax, and a lot of sales tax means eventually going into the fund for the environment. So I understand then that you have not met with regards to setting this up and putting it together. But what are your thoughts about this appropriation?
Director Bennett McGinty.
Just a clarifying question. We're specifically still talking about the sports and events grant. My apologies. I know GFO was also brought up, okay, thank you. So yes, we did initially meet, and I have had conversations with that group. I have not had a conversation with them since the bill was introduced. A few emails back and forth, but nothing substantial. And sort of after the meeting with Senator Rosen, I had reached out and again, similarly had said, you know, let's talk about that strategic plan. And I had not heard back. I do have a meeting actually on the books with them for next week. So hoping to learn more about what their goals and objectives are. I think, you know, bringing major sports and events to the state of Minnesota is critical for our success as a destination for a lot of people. I think we can all say that last week's event with the Craft Brewers Conference was a huge success. I know that there was a lot of energy and money injected into downtown Minneapolis and the surrounding areas, which is really exciting to see. So, you know, I think we are open to having those conversations and seeing how we can strategize to bringing large events to the state, and how, if those events might center in the metro area, how we can maybe do a better job of getting people to stay a little longer or add some days to the front end so that they can explore the rest of Minnesota.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one final comment. I'm glad that you're open to this, and I'm also glad that you're on the schedule to talk to her as well. And those folks that are involved in this have been very, I think quite excited about, you know, dedicating these dollars to this because it's simply going to be a win-win for everything. It's going to showcase Minnesota probably in a bigger fashion. The work that you do is also very important. I know you were funded last year fairly significantly, and coming out of COVID, everybody's excited. I mean, the lakes are going to be full of people, and all the events are now going to be taking off, and so I expect you're going to be very busy. So, but welcome, and thank you very much for your comments.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I couldn't agree more. It's exciting that all of these big events are coming to Minnesota. We seem to do a really good job of attracting really big, successful events. We've had Final Fours. We recently had the Super Bowl, although sadly the Vikings just missed participating in that one. We're good. People like to come to Minnesota for these big events because we have fantastic stadiums and resources, and we all know as Minnesotans how proud we are. It sort of begs the question to me, do we really need extra money directed in this direction when we seem to be so successful already at attracting these large events? And perhaps that's more of a comment than a question for you, Director, but I couldn't let this conversation end without kind of giving us some kudos and congratulations for the great job that we already do.
Director Bennett McGinty.
I have not submitted, you know, a number of large scale event bids myself, but what I do understand from Minnesota Sports and Events is that it's a very competitive process, and I know that it can get very expensive. And you really have to show exactly, you know, what you can do that's different than any sort of similar state elsewhere. And I think it's certainly, when it comes to things like the Super Bowl, we really capitalized on the idea of Bold North and got people to come here and brave the cold. But I think that we actually are in the middle of strategic planning right now. And one of the biggest things that came up is how do we celebrate the cold? But I think as of right now, just kind of dealing with that being such a large part of our year, it unfortunately makes it really challenging for us to score large events because people are afraid to come here and to freeze and to not know what parka to wear. So, you know, I think that's something we're working on, and we are looking forward to having those continued conversations with sports and events to see, you know, what other tactics we can use to submit bids or win bids. But I do know that the process is very competitive. Beyond that, I don't necessarily know how much they cost and what other folks are submitting in comparison, but that's kind of the little bit of expertise I can add to that.
You know, members, I think the discussion often turns into an either or, that we have to do one or the other. And I just, you know, I think I just checked my phone that the April proceeds that came in for revenue are significant for 1 month beyond the forecast. So, you know, we can do both. You know, we can do both the large corporate events and we can do the community events. We can do both. We have the skill set. I'm assuming you have the skill set, Director McGinty, to make these things happen. And so that investment, whether it's a fishing opener, a pheasant opener, the defeat of Jesse James Gay days, I know that those have, I know people come to that from all around the country as well. So, and big events. So we can do both. We can do all. And particularly when the demand is there. I don't know, Director McGinty, if Mr. Meyer has come with the numbers yet, Burr. If he does have that, if he doesn't have that, I would like Mr. Hagemeyer or Ms. Taylor to just find the items, either the appropriation or the language in our bill here in the side-by-side. Maybe they could highlight where we're at so we can read the proposal. So Director McGinty, is Mr. Meyer back?
I actually have been getting texts, so I won't put him through through that again. But I did find out that we only had 23 grants that were unfunded. One was partially funded, and the grants were for approximately $10,000 to $20,000 each.
Okay. And that list would be available publicly, correct? Is that correct?
Yes, we actually did share that out at our tourism conference a couple months ago, but I would also be happy to send it to this conference committee so that you all can take a look as you're making your decisions.
Mr. Hagemeyer, could you highlight the appropriations?
Sure, Mr. Chair, the appropriations you're looking at are going to be on the Article 1 side-by-side, and that would be on page R17. So the bottom of the page would say page R17-R1. In line 7.31, you'll see the start of the Senate side and the start of the House side. The Senate language includes the $1 million one-time appropriation and the $450,000 ongoing. And then below that on R18, you'll see the House appropriations of the administrative capacity, starting on House lines 22.26, and then the $10 million for recovery grants and the $250 for the Grand Portage grant.
And Director McGinty, on the $10 million, it's for Minnesota Tourism, doesn't direct anything with those grants. They just handle the pass-through. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We certainly set forward guidelines, obviously, and we are open to kind of expanding what those are. But traditionally, we've just given them out. And then, of course, we've done matching grants before, which requires a certain amount of follow-through. And we would obviously also have followed through with these grants, depending on if they were matching or not. It wouldn't matter. We would work with grants management at the governor's at administration to make sure that everything was working properly and that we were following through with what we need to track everything.
And Senator Ingebrigtsen, we have in there that the grant process would open at 8 a.m. rather than midnight, so people don't have to stay up all night to get in line, and that it stays open for 5 days. So that we would make sure it's fair for people rather than just the night owls that might be up ready to apply. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And I happen to be one of those night owls, by the way. But I won't be applying for any tourism money, although I may be taking part in whatever comes about in our great state. So maybe Mr. Hagemiller or Mr. Mueller can remind the committee just what was appropriated last year during the budget session for Explore Minnesota Tourism.
Go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, in last year's budget bill, we appropriated $15.434 million in fiscal year 22 and then $14.523 million in fiscal year 23, and that would continue on. That amount did include an operating increase. In the first year, included a $1 million recovery grant program. So that was just in the first year with one-time money.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Mr. Mueller, so the House, and maybe I can ask Mr. Hagemiller this, the House appropriation for this year is 10.465, is that correct? That's just for this?
Mr. Chair, the additional money for Explore Minnesota Tourism included in the House bill this year is $10,465,000. And that's a combination of the three appropriations I listed, the $10 million for the recovery grants, the $250,000 for the grant to the Grand Portage Band, and the $215,000 per year for the additional administrative capacity.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, thank you. That's it.
And Director McGinty, again, how many grant applications were unfulfilled that applied because the money had run out last year?
We had 23 unfulfilled, and one was partially funded.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just for clarity, 23 were turned down, but how many actually got received dollars?
130 communities.
Okay. Good.
Members, any other questions for Director Bennett McGinty?
Yeah, keep up the good work. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Next up will be the Pollution Control Agency. Senator Ingebrigtsen, we had some questions on environmental justice. So I think we have with us, let me just check who we've got here. I think Director Kadalka. Kirk Kadalka, Assistant Commissioner, is available for questions. Craig McDonald, Assistant Commissioner, and Tom Johnson, Legislative Director.
Okay. Yes, whoever would like to answer, several, well, at least a couple of places in this bill, I think last year might have been the same. We have what's called environmental justice. We also, I believe in the bill, we'll have a definition of environmental justice. Can anyone help me with that or where we exactly we are at? I don't believe it's in any standing legislation. I'm not sure of that. Maybe Mr. Stanley can help me out with that. But Mr. Kadalka, can you give me ideas what you mean by that?
Director Kadalka, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name for the record is Kirk Kadalka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. But I'm going to hand this over to my colleague, Craig McDonald.
Commissioner McDonald, welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Craig McDonald, Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy of the Pollution Control Agency. And to Chair Ingebrigtsen's question here, environmental justice has
not been. I'm sorry, it's not coming through.
We're not coming through. We don't have.
One moment.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, maybe while he is getting hooked up, we would have. Either Mr. Stanley or Ms. Taylor find the sections in the side-by-side?
Sure. That'd be great.
If
either one, Mr. Stanley or Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I can direct the committee. On R85 of Article 2, you'll find the definitions of environmental justice and environmental justice area. And then there's several related policy questions. I don't know if you want me to point those out as well, but you can find those on R87. There's a provision called Section 64. There's also Section 65 starting on R89, Section 66 starting on R90, and then Section 69 on R92. And Section 71 on R92 as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Director McDonald, okay to speak?
Yep.
To Commissioner McDonald.
Mr. Chair, members, is that better?
We still have a bit of an echo.
My apologies, 1 second. any better at this point?
It's a little better.
I'm going to have to log off and log back in. I'll be back in one.
Yeah. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I see we've got a couple other questions. Maybe.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. That's fine.
Yep. Representative Morrison, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my question relates to the concept of environmental justice, I guess. You know, as a physician, I like to look through environmental issues through a public health lens. And we've known for a long time that different communities are disproportionately impacted by pollution and climate change, which, of course, are also related. Now we have a lot of scientific evidence of the disproportionate impacts. I know I can see it in my, I'm taking care of much more asthma of pregnant women and young people, even here in Minnesota, where I think sometimes we have this idea that we're immune to some of this. We have pretty direct evidence that there are communities, and they tend to be low-income communities and communities of color, are disproportionately impacted by pollution. But this isn't just in the metro. This happens to people who are proximate to areas that heavily use pesticides, et cetera. So that, you know, this is a whole Minnesota impact. So given that, I was sort of surprised that there was no reference to environmental justice in the Senate bill, given that we know this is an urgent problem in Minnesota, and I know we all want to take care of all Minnesotans. You know, I'm just looking at this report that the American Lung Association published in 2021, The State of Air, and found that 4 in 10 people in the United States and Americans breathe polluted air, and that people of color were 61% more likely to live in a county with polluted air than white people. So I'm just wondering if someone from PCA could, given this discrepancy, if any of you could talk about actions that PCA is currently taking to address it, and tell us what additional resources and authority your agency needs to adequately assess these risks and address them.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's better.
Great. Apologies for the technical difficulties. To Representative Morrison's question, the MPCA has been continuing to work on environmental justice. It's a paramount importance to us to reduce the disproportionate impacts that we're seeing and that you quoted. On the air side, we're taking numerous steps here. One of the things that we regularly do is we identify facilities that are seeking a permit within 1 mile of what we define as an environmental justice community of concern. And as part of that process, we have an enhanced engagement effort with communities to ensure that they're aware of the facility's emissions, and can ask questions of the permitting facility, in that case, MPCA, to understand the air permit and what it might do for localized air quality there. However, as you asked for what are kind of gaps in authorities there, there is a gap as it pertains to the regulation of air toxics and some of the cumulative levels and effects analyses that this bill calls for. The cumulative levels and effects analyses are only required in one portion of Minneapolis and not in other environmental justice areas of concern. So that's an opportunity to work on. However, there are other actions that we're taking as an agency as well. We are also recognizing that compliance and enforcement has a role to play in environmental justice. And we award additional points in our scoring mechanism for facilities to receive inspections that are in environmental justice communities of concern. So that way, facilities that are in those communities are bumped to the top of the list once we have met federal requirements as well as it pertains to inspection frequency. In addition to that, and where we've been really successful is targeting grants to environmental justice communities and really working on that kind of compliance and assistance side as well. So one of the things that we have done is we had a recent grant to small business assistance that helped over 100 neighborhood sources replace gasoline-powered landscaping equipment with electric landscaping equipment. And those smaller engines can be, you know, a source of various different pollution. And it's important that we address all sources of pollution, not just facilities. So thinking about mobile sources like cars, which we've done through Clean Cars Minnesota, which I know this body is well aware of, as well as thinking about other unpermitted sources as well, which could be a gas station that is not required to have an air quality permit. In addition to that, we've also used the VW settlement dollars and the funds there and set a goal of spending 40% of that overall fund, which is $47 million plus interest in environmental justice communities of concern. So as part of that grant making process, we do include scoring criteria that will award additional points to projects in environmental justice areas. And those are just a handful of the ways that we're continuing to address environmental justice on the air quality side.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. McDonnell. Just a quick follow-up in terms of, because asthma is just on my mind, given the challenges that we're seeing across the state, but particularly in environmental justice communities. I'm wondering if MPCA has data on the way that these health impacts create challenges. Is there information about kids missing school, people missing work? You know, how else this can impact the wider community and economy?
Commissioner McDowell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrison, the MPCA recently published a report called Life and Breath, which is an update of two different reports from 2015 and 2019 that really focused in on an update to the disproportionate impacts of air quality pollution and found that, you know, hospitalizations and death are still heavily associated with air pollution in Minnesota. And that's disproportionately found in our BIPOC or Black, Indigenous, or people of color of communities, as well as lower to moderate income communities as well. And we know that if somebody is hospitalized, they are being taken out of the workforce, to your point. Or if a child is hospitalized or has to go in for an asthma attack, they're missing school. So while we don't have, you know, data from PCA that quantifies those impacts, we know that anytime you are going to be seeking a higher level of care, that takes you away from important activities that, you know, are related to education or just the workforce in general. And so it's an area that we are continuing to do research on, working closely with our colleagues at the Department of Health.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. McDonnell. Those are hospitalizations and deaths. Those are some chilling words that I know we're all concerned about. And I'm not sure what if the objection is to the expression environmental justice. We can rename it if that would be helpful. But boy, I'm so glad that we can have this public conversation about these urgent issues. And I hope that we're able to come together in this conference committee so that we can address these urgent issues for Minnesotans. Thanks for your comments, Mr. McDonnell.
Representative Lippert, and then Senator Ingebrigtsen. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. McDonnell as well. I have a couple questions. And I appreciate the opportunity for this conversation too. It seems to me that we have a moral obligation as Minnesotans to make sure that everyone has clean air to breathe and a safe place to live, regardless of the color of your skin or how much money you have available to you. And that's something that we can address together. And one thing I want to ask about the Environment Protection Agency's research has concluded that low-income tribal, indigenous, and communities of color are more likely to live near contaminated lands, which is one of the key reasons these communities face increased exposure to environmental hazards. Can you talk, Ms. McDonnell, about the costs associated with cleaning up contaminated lands in these communities? And are there ways that we as a legislature can pass laws to prevent these types of contaminations from occurring in the first place?
Commissioner McDonnell.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would actually turn that over to my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka, who handles our land issues and remediation issues.
Commissioner Kadelka.
Well, thank you, Chair and committee members, for the question. We are incorporating environmental justice into our cleanup remediation programs. And an example of that is our efforts as we're looking back at sites that have been previously cleaned up or addressed and changing health values. For instance, soil vapor intrusion is something within the last 15 years. We handled a number of sites prior to that and are going back and looking at those sites. We are prioritizing those, including looking at and putting higher up on the list those that are environmental justice communities, because as you noted, they have historically had more sites that are historically contaminated, and we're trying to reduce that burden. Other examples are we have in the past and received some dollars to help and target investigation and cleanup plans for areas within environmental justice communities. The governor has $1 million in his budget proposal to do and continue that work, to target those areas to help reduce those burdens in areas that are facing not only the things that my colleague has talked about on the air side, but those contaminated sites that were mentioned also. In terms of dollars, I don't have any dollar estimates to share with you, but we do know that those are real impacts on those communities, not only the potential risks to human health, but also lost economic activities if those lands aren't able to be developed and turned into community amendments or businesses.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner Kadelka. I want to fold climate into the conversation a little bit now. Climate's a key concern of mine, a key concern of ours on the House side. I know I was disappointed to see that climate isn't being addressed in the Senate bill. And I often talk about climate as the challenge that makes so many other challenges worse. And are there ways that climate change is compounding the problems facing environmental justice communities due to hotter summers, poor air quality, higher volumes of water moving across contaminated lands? Can you talk a little bit about the impacts that we're seeing right now?
Which commissioner, Kadelka or McDonald or both?
Mr. Chair, I will take the first stab at it. To Representative Lippert's question, we are seeing the impacts of climate change. We know Minnesota is getting warmer, it's getting wetter. So when we think about those two issues, right, increasing heat and, you know, increasing wetness, we know that they have disproportionate impacts on those who are an already historically disproportionate impact. So once again, that could be Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, as well to lower to moderate incomes. Specific concerns could be, as you see, an urban heat island effect increasing, right? So we're getting hotter and hotter. We know that communities that are environmental justice communities of concern have less tree coverage there. So the issues with heat stroke or, you know, other heat impact illnesses could increase as well. When it comes to flooding events and thinking about environmental justice there, we know that as more and more areas are prone to floods, you're going to see more and more people who can't get to work. It impacts things like public transportation and other things like that that are important for someone who may not have a car as well there, if we're thinking about flooding out a culvert or something like that. And that's an environmental justice impact as well. In addition to that, folks who may be medically fragile, you know, there's the opportunity for increased vector-borne diseases, be it ticks or mosquitoes and things like that. So an increasing prevalence of diseases as well that are all impacts that, you know, typically are borne by those who have historically borne disproportionate impacts as well. So we're seeing it play out in real time at this point.
Commissioner Kadelka, did you want to take the second part?
Mr. Chair and committee members, could you repeat the second part of the question?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is basically, you know, how is climate change impacting environmental justice communities right now due to hotter summers, poor air quality, more higher volume of water moving across our landscapes? What are we seeing already in our state?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Chair and committee members, thanks for the question. You know, my colleague did a really good job at outlining those pieces, so I will just leave the answer there.
And Representative Lippert, I can add one other piece that I neglected. We're seeing increasing wildfires as well. The Canadian wildfires that, you know, impacted Minnesota to a great degree last summer, as we see continued drought conditions across the Mountain West and into Canada, you can see more poor air quality days as well. And that's requiring folks to stay inside. It's requiring people to address other issues related to being outside, or if you don't have air conditioning and you rely on open windows or even an AC unit, that's a window unit and some things like that, that can impact you. So it's another opportunity there as we're seeing.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. McDonald. You know, a quick comment. I think we're hearing how our focus on environmental justice in the House side bill, the House bill, is those are dollars well spent, and the climate and equity fit together. And we need to be taking the advantage of the opportunity we have to invest resources right now with the budget surplus. These problems aren't going to wait. Climate change isn't going to wait. We have a moral obligation to respond, and we can right now. So I appreciate this conversation.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of discussion here about environmental justice, and I guess I would ask the commissioner, Mr. McDonald, I understand that the Biden administration just created a new office of environmental justice. So I'm wondering why we would be, because I don't believe it's identified in policy. I don't believe it's identified in statute, environmental justice in our state. Maybe I'm wrong. I see a lot of it in the bill, but it's new language. So I'm wondering, you're certainly aware of what's coming from Washington, D.C. Are we going to be like a little bit of an overreach compared to what the feds are requiring now? I know we've been doing air testing and quality air testing emissions for areas. I think back to the days when Katie Sieben, Senator Sieben was here, and she made the case to put air quality emission technology in communities close to industry. It was not identified as low income and or Black or Indigenous. It was simply anybody that lived within a certain area of that type of industry. So I know we've been doing this for some time. I'm wondering what's happening with the information, if that's just been set aside, or maybe you can give me a little idea about what's coming down from the federal with regards to the term environmental justice, because unless Mr. Stanley or Ms. Taylor can come up with a statute that actually says environmental justice in our statutes, I might be barking up the wrong tree. But can you help me out with that, Mr. McDonald?
Commissioner McDonald.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is a priority of the Biden administration and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. They've been quite clear on that. So I think the potential for overreach is not what you may think. It's actually about an alignment here. We see that the federal government has initiated a project called Justice 40, which is requiring the federal agencies to spend 40% of their existing funds to address environmental justice when it's related to climate funding there. Now, these agencies are issuing guidance and they are trying to grapple with it. It was announced in the spring of 2021. So there's not a lot of information there, but I use it as a point to say that the federal government is moving forward and dedicating significant resources to alleviating some of the environmental justice issues that we see as it relates to climate change, as well as an infrastructure, right? There's been a big push, and other colleagues could speak more to this, to make sure that we are reducing lead pipes and lead service lines and issues like that. We know that that is an environmental justice issue as well. So there is just a renewed focus at the federal level here, and there is alignment. In addition to the funds that are being released, both in the bipartisan infrastructure law and as well as Justice 40, we're seeing EPA conduct more and more activities in environmental justice communities of concern. And colleagues in other states in the upper Midwest, in the Region 5 states, in Michigan, as well as Illinois, have seen challenges from EPA based on the issuance of permits related to specific facilities on the basis of those permits being in environmental justice communities of concern. There was a metal shredder in Chicago called General Iron that was a focus of this, as well as another facility, a couple facilities in Michigan. And so those are opportunities that I point to related to the federal government and actions there. As it relates to the second part of your question, right, what are we doing internally with the air emissions inventory work that we're doing and air monitoring there? The emissions inventory demonstrates higher risks, as we've seen, as well as those air monitoring pieces. And when we say higher risks, you can find it in some of the information that we have online. We say that the statewide average for an individual to breathe air that might be above a health risk guideline, and again, that's a guidance value, not necessarily a standard, is 51%, meaning that all of the emission sources in their area may lead to air quality being above a health guideline for 51% of Minnesotans. However, when you break it down to folks who are in low-income communities, it increases to 66% of those folks may be breathing air quality above a health risk guideline. And if you talk about communities of color and indigenous communities, that's 93% are above those risk guidelines here in Minnesota. And that's Minnesota-specific data that's informing that. So we have been continuing to focus our air monitoring opportunities in, you know, densely populated areas, as well as a statewide network that's informing this. Facilities are one point of part of the problem, as I mentioned, but we know that the sources of air pollution are not just facilities, right? It is, as I said, traffic and mobile sources and neighborhood sources as well. So it's a complex problem, and it does require an all hands on deck effort here if we're going to make headway in eliminating disproportionate impacts.
Senator Ingridson.
Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor this. I think there's lots of bill, part of the bills that we still have to discuss here. But Commissioner, with the We Breathe report, what kind of air quality came from that? Are you familiar with that report? Did air emissions get better after that We Breathe report that you had?
Commissioner McDonald.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the most recent version of that Air We Breathe focused in on the metro and then looked at Duluth, Rochester, and another city in greater Minnesota. And so what we did find, right, is that air pollution in the metro has generally improved. When we say air pollution, focusing on fine particulate matter, which are those fine particles, PM2.5, that really get kind of deep into your system and into your lungs and can contribute to asthma as well as heart disease and those kind of just cardiopulmonary risks as well. So while that we have seen an overall reduction in PM2.5 by 30%, and then we've seen ozone, which is a secondary pollution that's created basically as a reaction in sunlight with nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, VOCs, and that also contributes to lung issues and just difficulty breathing. We've seen a reduction there of 10%. But what we found, and this is the stark point, is that it's disproportionately beneficial, right? The folks who have been historically disproportionately burdened by air pollution are still seeing disproportionate impacts and are seeing, you know, greater levels of hospitalizations and greater levels of death as well.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I'm going to finish with this last two questions. So the air quality is getting better. Is it not getting better in where you call it the environmental justice communities? And I guess you seem to be using that definition in your research and in your work moving forward. Again, I need you to point out to me where in statute that is, you know, short of us passing this particular legislation, which identifies environmental justice. How many parts of Minnesota could be defined as in environmental justice areas? Do you have any idea?
Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair, and as you noted, the definition is not in statute at this point. However, it is a definition that Minnesota uses to target our resources as well at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And we currently define environmental justice as census tracts from 2010, where 40% of the people reported less than 185% of the federal poverty level, and 50% of the population were people of color or federally recognized tribal areas. And so that accounts for, I'm pulling it up right now just for the data there, it's roughly, based on that, 41% of census tracts in Minnesota are environmental justice by that definition. And as you go out from that definition, you could include more or less.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Ingebrigtsen,
I'm going to finish with that. So this is your definition, not anybody else's definition. This is the definition that the MPCA came up with without any authority of the legislature.
Commissioner McDonald.
Mr. Chair, this is a widely acknowledged definition of environmental justice that mirrors work from the Environmental Protection Agency as well as other agencies as well. And so it's mirroring that.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No, that's good for now. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner McDonald.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I thought you might be advocating for Section 10A there, you know, or subdivision 10A to get that definition in. I almost thought that that's what you were doing, but.
Well, my concerns, Mr. Chair, is where does this environmental justice term end? I mean, people know where they live. They live there because of their, I think they still have a choice to live where they live, and And my whole point is that we have addressed this over the years, and now I'm being told that the air quality is actually getting better. It wasn't that long ago that I had an expert scientist, actually scientist, and hard to believe that I would listen to a scientist, Representative Hansen, but nevertheless I did. I asked him what he thought about the major rivers in Minnesota. Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? He said, by far, they're getting much better than they were in the 80s. So, you know, I just wonder where it's going to go. I just wonder where the environmental justice is going to go. It's not only going to be just for the environment. I think it's going to be other things. And I would caution the legislature to put that in legislation unless we truly, truly understand where its limitations or unlimitations go. And I care, doctor. I care about the people who have asthma. I care about people who get sick. Minnesota's a lot better than what is portrayed to be here, I believe. And I think to the credit of the MPCA, they've been doing a good job in the 16 years that I've been here. And I think they've been staying on top of it. I don't know that we have to create anything different. And as far as the global warming, global climate change, we can agree to disagree on that all day long. So I think we should move forward here, and there's got to be some other questions in the bill that we want to talk about. So thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wazowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some comments and questions sort of intermingled here, but I just want to point out that the current definition that the MPCA uses for environmental justice has these areas all across the state. Really all across the state, every part of the state has these environmental justice areas in it. Just want to point that out. I think we have this idea that it's focused in the metro, and it really is all across the state. And I will say, you know, one of the big reasons why things are better now in terms of air and water pollution is because we passed laws and enforced laws that actually are effective, right? So we have the Clean Water Act. We have other legislation that's happened on the federal level, on the state level, that we've said we're going to regulate chemicals. Whether it's air emissions, things that are going to the water, things that are going in the soil. That's why it's getting better, because we actually took action to do something about the issue rather than waiting for some body somewhere that might do something. And so I think that's really a really important piece to note here is that this is what we do, right? This is our job as legislators, is we see a problem and we come forward with a solution. And one of the big problems in the environmental area in this state and around the country, probably around the world, is the issue of environmental justice. And I just want to point out a few other things. I think when we talk about this, it's really easy to be disconnected from, like, what does this mean in people's lives? I know we've already heard about some of the health impacts, but I want to specifically point out the health impacts that this has on children. I think we all care about children. We all want children to be in school. We want children to be healthy. We don't want them to miss out on things because of health concerns. And so I just want to sort of reflect back on that and say, like, what we know about air pollution is that it increases, as has been said, more school absences because kids are missing out on school, right? We all care about kids being educated. And if they're missing out on school, that's not just bad for their health because of the health impacts. It's bad for all the other things that come from missing school. It's bad for all those things associated with more school absences. You know, we're seeing higher levels of asthma. We're seeing... And this is all stuff that's on the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences website. There have been studies on women and children that breathing that fine particulate matter that Commissioner McDonald mentioned may actually alter the size of a developing brain. So, and anyone who knows anything about the developing brain, that time period when the brain is developing, that those impacts can be long-term. So you can see these impacts in adolescence, where you're seeing cognitive and emotional problems later in adolescence, just from the exposure to those chemicals during that time period when brains are developing. Prenatal exposure to polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which is one of these chemicals floating around, some of these chemicals floating around was associated with brain developmental effects, slower processing speed, ADHD, and other neurobehavioral problems in youth. ADHD and other studies have come up as a thing. Low birth weights when there's prenatal exposure to particulate matter. Women exposed to high levels of fine particulate matter during pregnancy, particularly in the third trimester, may have up to twice the risk of having a child with autism. These are just, I mean, I could go on and on. There's a lot of research here. But my point is that
if we as a body care about women and children and families in this country and our state, that we actually, this is an issue we have to tackle. This is having, this is wreaking havoc on so many different things in communities that have these high levels of pollution. And, you know, I've heard concerns from people across the political spectrum about kids with autism. I've heard concerns about where we're putting too much medication into kids with ADHD and all these other things. But the reality is that we can prevent these things from happening. And one of the ways we can do that is to ensure that the folks living in these communities, that we have a definition, that we know what it means, that we're doing what we can as a state to say, we don't want these things to happen to the kids and families in these communities, and we're going to do something about it. So I appreciate Representative Lee's work on these issues. I think this is a really important, impactful discussion that we need to have. It's a really huge thing that we need to tackle. I actually saw on the EPA's website that environmental justice, I'm sure it was going on in smaller communities before this, but really sort of became a larger issue in the civil rights movement, right? That was in the 1960s. So this is not an issue that it's just like yesterday we found out about this. This has been going on for a long time. People have been fighting against pollution and other things for decades, if not longer. And I think it's time for us to step up and acknowledge that and to also say we're actually going to do something about it. So I just want to, again, express appreciation for Representative Lee's work on getting this in there, this really comprehensive sort of way to address this issue.
Commissioner McDonald.
I'm not sure I heard a question in there, Chair Hansen, but you know, Representative Wozlik made a number of great points as related to the impacts.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be brief, but I just did want to say that I'm certain that we all care about Minnesota. I don't see this as sort of an anti-Minnesotan conversation. I think this is a very Minnesotan conversation because we're all so proud of our state. We want to make it as great as it can be, and we all know that it can be. You know, as we learn new things, I think we have to change and adapt. There was a reference to we've done air quality measuring for many years. Perhaps we need to change the way we do it now, or we need to direct it more. When you look at the paper, every single day, we're seeing articles about workforce challenges, and we're seeing articles about childhood mental health challenges. And if we can just go big picture for a minute, all of this is related, right? If we have some of our fastest growing communities disproportionately impacted by pollution, by climate change, and then the acceleration of the two, we've got to act. And if we are, we know that some of the key to unlocking mental health is getting kids outside and getting them, nature deficit disorder is a real challenge in our world today. And if we're creating this catch-22 of you need to be outside more, but you can't be outside more because we have fires and we have worsening air pollution, we have accelerating climate change, we don't have adequate tree cover in our urban heat deserts. All of this is related. So I think there's real urgency to addressing these issues. We talk about increase in vector-borne diseases. We're looking at a potential another COVID surge. We have to be thinking about how do we keep our lungs as healthy as possible. And some of that is making sure that we're breathing clean air and we're creating spaces where kids can be outside and they can explore, they can get off their screens, they can be healthy, and then they can be productive members of society. So no question, I do want to thank MPCA for just excellent answers to many questions. I really hope that we can get some agreement on some of these important issues going forward. We got to do this, and we're going to do it because we're all so proud of our great state. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We talked about the definitions, and I believe there are appropriations for air quality monitoring. Mr. Hagemeyer, could you find the appropriations for air quality monitoring or environmental justice so we could just make sure the conference committee's on the same page of comparison?
Sure, Mr. Chair, if you just give me 1 second here, it'll be the Article 1 side by side, and then it would be on page R6. So Article 1, sorry, side by side at the bottom of page R6-Article 1 on the House side, line 6.6, you'll see the $9,080,000 the second year, so the fiscal year 23, and then you'll see the base appropriations from the Environmental Fund starting on line 6.12. There was also on line 6.17 through 6.22, $5 million for statewide air monitoring program. And then 6.23 through 6.21 is $540,000 of one-time money to purchase three air monitoring devices for pollutants. 6.32 to 7.2, excuse me, is $500,000 one-time money for a community air monitoring system pilot program. And then on line 7.3 through 7.6 is $500,000 for the adoption of rules for air toxic emissions as specified in the bill.
Thank you. That was helpful. Commissioner McDonald and Commissioner Kudelka, I think we have some members with questions about PFAS. And so maybe, I don't know which one of you would like to be available or both for that. We have maybe Ms. Taylor could highlight the PFAS provisions of the bill. So we're prepared for that.
Mr. Chair, the PFAS provisions can be found in Article 4 on the House side, and that starts on R112 of the side-by-side for Article 2 on the Senate. And there's a number of provisions that would include the five provisions banning the manufacture and sale of certain products, as well as the disclosure requirements and composting labeling, and then the adoption of rules for water quality standards, the health risk limits, and then also the FASB firefighting foam ban.
Representative Wozwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is probably a question for Commissioner Kudelka, but I was sort of reading through a lot of recent news coverage, and the past few years, there's been a lot of conversation about PFAS in Minnesota. I think we're all familiar with the 3M settlement, that big one from several years ago that was $850 million, I believe. But there was also a recent one with the city of Bemidji because they they sort of linked it to the firefighting foam from their airport. And they actually had to, they did a couple of things, but one of the things that they did was they were working with 3M to build new treatment facilities. I think what I'm interested in getting a better grasp on is we know that we got that $850 million from 3M as this part of the settlement several years ago. I'm wondering if you can talk about what the settlement money that's going towards the 14 affected communities, what that money is being used for, and then sort of what the long-term plan is. From my understanding with conversations with the agency, that amount of money isn't going to be the long-term solution, at least from my conversations, that's what I understand. And if I'm wrong, you can correct me on that, but that amount of money will help in some ways, but that it's not enough to address the larger issue of these forever chemicals that don't go away. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about like what that money is being used for right now or what it will be used for. And then you or anyone else at the agency has any sense of like ongoing costs of that water treatment. And the reason I bring it up is because we have several provisions in the House bill that ban the use of PFAS in products. And what we know about PFAS is that it goes from the product to the human body, from the product to the environment, from the environment to the groundwater and to the drinking water. And so the idea of preventing things that cost more than $850 million to fix, I think is really important. And we know that the cost on the front end to prevent is less expensive. So if you could just talk about how that's played out with the PFAS settlement and thoughts on what are the costs going forward with that?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the work that we're doing with the 3M settlement, as the legislator mentioned, we are working on providing safe and sustainable drinking water, whether someone is on a municipal drinking water system or a private well system. And so about $317 million has been set aside for capital costs just for building those water supply treatment systems. So in some communities, that is building entirely new treatment systems to address their municipal locations. And you see this in the case of St. Paul Park, Cottage Grove, Woodbury, Oakdale, and possibly Lake Elmo, depending on their growth. In addition, we have whole home treatment systems that are being used on townships and cities, townships such as Great Cloud Island or Denmark Township, and cities such as, West Lakeland Township, and then small cities from the example of Afton to much larger cities like Cottage Grove and Lake Elmo, where we have a large number of private wells still, and we're hooking them up to municipal water. So that $317 million is just to build those facilities. The plan then puts aside $115 million for the ongoing operation and maintenance of those facilities. And what we're looking at, that money is targeted for 20 years to continue to run the operation and maintenance of those municipal systems, and 30 years for those private homeowners and changeouts for those systems. You are correct, Representative Wazowick, that this is, we will try to use this money for as long as it lasts, but behind it is a consent order, which is a 2007 consent order signed with 3M and the state, where they will have to continue on those costs. And we anticipate, you know, we'll have to continue to operate those systems. The plan also invests $70 million in drinking water protection. And this is really to get the underlying problem. Those first two items we talked about, that's just about what's coming out of the tap. There's still the underlying problem there. And $70 million is to look at that impact of PFAS on surface water, groundwater, and some stormwater conveyance systems there that still has PFAS in the environment. And so those are the efforts that we're working in those communities there. You mentioned the city of Bemidji, and the legislature a couple years ago did build a drinking water treatment system because all of their wells were impacted as a result of PFAS from a training area at the airport there. The Department of Health is right now going through the process and will complete by 2023 a review of PFAS in all municipal drinking water systems. And so they have results from some of that. And I'm just going to share those just really quickly here. Right now, 30% of the community drinking water systems have been tested, and that represents about 67% of the community system water users, about 3 million. And in 67% of those systems, PFAS has been detected. And so, and they're still working on to see which may have it over the health-based values. So when it's detected, and maybe some of the wells have it detected in various communities, and they're still able to operate because it's below the health-based value set by the Department of Health, or it's in some wells and they're able to rely on other wells and shut down wells. And so this picture will become even clearer as the Department of Health continues its work.
Representative Wazowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think the point I was trying to make here was just, you know, treating this problem is really, really, really expensive, and it requires long-term investments. So if there wasn't this settlement with 3M, this hundreds of millions of dollars, who would pay for it? I think the answer is taxpayers, right? So the folks who had nothing to do with putting these chemicals out there in the first place would be responsible for paying for these things. So I think it's really important, and I know that we have done some PFAS stuff in the past, which is really great. I think the piece that I want to emphasize is the prevention piece. And so one of the sort of three buckets of the PFAS blueprint, one of the three buckets is prevention. So preventing PFAS pollution wherever it's possible to do. And one of the ways that we can do that is by preventing the PFAS from getting into the environment and then getting into the groundwater and the drinking water. And I think one thing I want to note is there's been a lot of conversations about, you know, the new versus the old PFAS and the new PFAS that is being used to replace the old ones that have been phased out because they were so terrible are actually more mobile in water. And so they actually are more likely to be doing that, to having that movement and getting into the drinking water and the groundwater. So I think it's really important that when we're talking about addressing a problem like PFAS contamination holistically, that we do all of the pieces. And so there's funding in the House bill for PFAS community grants. There's several provisions that would ban the use of PFAS in specific products. And those are products that are widely used and things that PFAS is commonly found in. So textiles, There was just a report from the Guardian that forever chemicals were found in 60% of children's waterproof or stain-resistant textiles. And these are things that kids are using. Kids are sleeping on, kids are wrapping themselves in the blankets, kids are wearing the clothes. And we know that a lot of, I don't even know if it's 100% now, but a high percentage of children that are born already have PFAS in their system because it's been transferred through umbilical cord blood or other meat or breast milk. And so I think that one of these things that we can do is this prevention piece is to say, we're going to stop using PFAS. The state of Maine actually recently passed legislation that said they're not going to do it in any in anything except that's essentially an essential use. And so that's something that they've done, that they've started that process. And I think it's important that we work on this prevention piece. You know, I don't think we're going to have agreement on all of these provisions, but there are some that I think kids' products, for example, I don't think any of us want kids to be exposed to these nasty chemicals. Ski wax, we're Minnesota, we have a big skiing culture. The industry's already moving that way. So I'm hopeful that we can continue the conversation on this topic and hopefully come to an agreement on something to continue to tackle this problem and not leave it all towards to the agency and the taxpayers of Minnesota to pick up the pieces after these chemicals have already been in the environment. Thank you.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just want to echo what the representative said. The best way forward is to prevent this. Prevent it from getting to our wastewater treatment plants, prevent it from going to our landfills and others. And most often these are run by municipalities or counties that have to deal with it. And it only becomes more expensive if we have to manage it and then ultimately clean it up afterwards. So it's why the Minnesota PFAS blueprint puts that strong effort on pollution prevention, and many other states are looking in those areas too. Thank you.
Sam Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just going back to the language in the House bill, maybe Mr. Kudelka could walk us through the agency's perspective on this California language that was introduced and found its way into the final bill that came to the floor. The California language had a provision that needed the agencies to establish that companies intentionally added PFAS. And I think the idea there was that we didn't want to catch or stick people with fines and penalties if they had accidentally or inadvertently or somehow without knowing had used a product that contained trace amounts of PFAS. That was the California language, and I'm assuming what their intent was. And this bill actually goes far, far more extreme than California did and excludes that provision that would give some opportunity for those that unintentionally had a product for sale that may have contained some trace amounts of PFAS. So with this whole discussion about trying to prevent any PFAS ever from being put into a landfill or other places where it potentially impact human health, I'm trying to figure out, you know, is there a way that we could be less extreme than California in this language and still accomplish our goals? Maybe Mr. Kudelka could address that.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there are a number of states that have bans for PFAS and a number of states that are proposing them. And they all do it a little differently, whether it's intentionally added or PFAS being present for other location, for other reasons. Whether it's intentionally added or not, PFAS being present in the product still provides exposure pathways that could impact human health and also then end up in our waste streams. So our look is really at eliminating PFAS from all its known uses. While sometimes it may not be intentionally added, it is used in a process, in a manufacturing process, where it is very likely to get into the product. And so we are open to have conversations with the legislature on which way they would like to go with this. Both of the options can work. And, you know, again, any PFAS whether it's intentionally added or not, is still going to end up in our waste streams.
Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think the House bill language is, and if you have the bill in front of you, Mr. Kudelka, it's in 98.13, very specifically is pulled, and I can almost go verbatim, from the California language. That's the extreme side of this that's coming over from a state that clearly has been helping Democrats craft this language. I don't mean to be difficult here. I'm just trying to figure out if we could be at least, if we're going to mimic that language, maybe, Kurt, you could address it. I asked earlier, and I don't think you did. If you did, I missed it. But is there a way the agency could help guide us through this process today coming through the language in this conference committee? And could we be less extreme than California, was the question, and still accomplish our goals?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the most expansive PFAS legislation is that's in Maine, and we do see many similarities of the legislation introduced here in Minnesota that is similar to what is in Maine. There are multiple ways to do it. Whether you can start at intentionally added or do any PFAS in the product, all of them are going to help. So we are open to have those conversations with the committee members on which way they would like to go. At the end of the day, how PFAS gets in the product is less relevant than is PFAS getting into our environment and impacting human health and the environment. So be very happy to work with the committee members on which way they would like to move forward. And we can lean on what other states, since they do it different ways of different states, and help bring that experience to the committee.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, you keep referencing Maine. Does their language contain no discussion around intent to add? Is that why you keep mentioning it, or does it?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the reason I keep mentioning Maine is because it is the most expansive. It covers the number of products. It has some specific language banning it from specific items right now, and then builds in all PFAS from numerous products out into the future. I would need to double check here and see whether Maine uses intentionally added only, or how it compares to other states such as Washington, which is also banning PFAS in various products too.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Well, Mr. Kudelka, that's why I'm specifically bringing it up, and why I was curious why you keep mentioning Maine. It'd be nice to know if we would be pushing in the House language the most extreme position, when maybe we could accomplish our goals of working towards getting at these upstream sources without going so far as to penalize, which in this language I think is producers of juvenile products that may contain trace amounts of PFAS. In your position, Mr. Kudelka, maybe it would be good to get some feedback, do some work on this. I think it would be good for us to get some feedback from MPCA as to what's working around the country. And that would be great to have that as a part of this conversation. At the moment, it doesn't sound like that you have that information, because if we can get at this issue and work with producers using a carrot approach as opposed to a full-on stick, that would be great. And especially since we're taking, what could be considered, a bit of a first bite at the apple, which I think it's really good that we're talking about this. And I brought that up in committee many times as we've debated how to move this PFAS language forward. But if we go all stick, all in, right out of the gate, that's going to be really difficult. So I hope that, you could find out for us, Mr. Kudelka, how this language, or if maybe this language is what other states are doing, since you keep mentioning them, I'd love to know what's working and what isn't, because in this case, Minnesota is potentially going to be impacted by the most extreme language ever proposed in the United States relative to this issue, and even more extreme than California. So I'm trying to figure out if there's a path forward on this, because at the moment it seems like we're probably going to be at an impasse because it's so extreme. I would love for us to work on this in a way that, you know, other places maybe have had success, and working on the upstream sources. And Mr. Kadoka, if you don't have the answers today, that's okay. But it is something we've been talking about for a long time, and I wish PCA would be more prepared to offer concrete evidence of what's working other places if it can be replicated. Now, I don't have any issue with Minnesota doing something groundbreaking. If we're doing something that is unique and special, that's great. But at the same time, I'm worried about this language that's being discussed today. And we're talking about it like, this is absolutely the way forward, and we have to do something. And the stories that are being told today, I get it. I want to get at this issue. I don't want anybody to ever be hurt by PFAS ever again. At the same time, we have to, one way or another, be able to talk about this and work on this together. And if we're doing something that's more extreme even than California or Maine, it seems like that's not groundbreaking. That's unfortunately going to impede us from having any real success. So I'm not sure that MPCA has any more to offer on that, but if Kurt has any more comments relative to my concern on the extreme language here, I wouldn't mind listening.
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you know, for the implementation of it, I'll just tack that piece. The easiest way for the state to implement it would be for any amount of PFAS in the product, because that is the easiest for us to sample for. The use of the words intentionally added adds another layer that has to be added on, where the agency would have to then work with the manufacturer to see if they were intentionally added. So if the question is about how it would be most effective for the state to implement it, that would be the question. Both intentionally added or just the presence of PFAS will reduce significantly the PFAS going into our environment and impacting human health in the environment. And so, you know, we are open to have that conversation if that is something the legislature is interested in looking at, just intentionally added versus all PFAS in a product. You know, I think that's something we're very open to. If you're asking for results, anything with PFAS would remove, banning it would remove more PFAS from the system than if we just did intentionally added. So these really are policy choices to be made depending on various variables and goals of the legislation.
Mr. Chair, my internet connection may be unstable, so I dropped the video, but I just was able to confirm that Maine's language does have off-ramps relative to the intentionally added issue. And so if I'm able to add that to the conversation, I sure wish that MPCA could. And Kirk, I don't mean to be especially critical, but no, that's something that I think MPCA should know coming into this discussion, especially since we've been talking about it for over a year. It's been, for me, almost 3 years. I think that MPCA could be more proactive in its approach to trying to give help to those of us that want legislation and could help us to craft legislation that could be something that could actually make it through this process and work with producers of products. And I hope that, you know, I'm certainly offering, I would like to be a partner in that. And if there could be more that MPCA could be doing to be proactive on this in assisting us, I'm certainly suggesting that I'd like to be a part of that if there are conversations going on about this behind closed doors and I'm missing opportunities, you know, well, That's on me. But if none of that is happening, then I'm suggesting that it should be, and MPCA should be a leader on this, rather than I'm digging up information that isn't available, apparently, when the question comes up. I'm just learning about the main language having the off-ramps as opposed to what we see here in the House language. So, you know, that's something that I think we really do have to work on. And I'm certainly going to be pressing towards that as opposed to some of the extreme language we're seeing in the bill.
Just a few things. So when we're addressing the commissioners, if we could address them as commissioner rather than first name, also any of the our peers, if we could address the senators as senators and representatives as representatives, if we could just proceed on that for the future. We'll go to the author of most of these provisions, Representative Wasilek, who has introduced these bills and moved them through the process. Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, these things didn't come from MPCA. They didn't come with these bans to us. This was something that myself and several other legislators, Representative Jordan and Representative Katiza Watun, have been working on together because we're all concerned about PFAS. I do just want to make a note that the MPCA's mission is to protect the environment and human health. And that's why, as you heard from Commissioner Kudelka, that's why they prefer the language that doesn't have intentionally added because it is easier as a regulatory agency to actually regulate that. I understand the concerns, Representative Pinesman, that you presented, and I think in the past we've also considered that language, if not included it, and I'm open to that conversation. The goal here, from my perspective, and I think from members of the committee that care about PFAS, is to get something passed and to start doing something about the issue. So if adding intentionally added language, as much as I don't want to do it, because it makes things more difficult for the PCA and honestly for manufacturers, because they have to know if, you know, they have to say they're intentionally adding it. I think that if that's what it takes to get any of these bans passed, I think I'm certainly willing to do that, open to that conversation. But I also, you know, didn't want to come into conference committee with that already in here if that's something that we can have a conversation about. So came in with the strongest language possible. I think it's certainly great to have conversations about if we can make some tweaks to the language to make it work better for folks and to make them get on board. So happy to have that conversation and in the future going forward.
And Representative Hinesman, to your point, there isn't any background conversation going on. This is the point and this is the place. Senator Ingebrigtsen or any of the other senators, any comments or thoughts or questions on the PFAS components?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, I do. Those, I'm sure you remember last year we had a appropriation, I believe Senator Weber put in the budget last year for PFAS wastewater study for landfills. The task force, which was created in that bill, just started meeting recently. Mr. Kudelka, can you talk to me as to how that's going and how many meetings have you had since we passed that legislation?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. So we, as mentioned by Senator Ingebrigtsen, the group has come together. It is a mix of wastewater operators and solid waste operators. And we are had a few meetings to start out this process. The legislation had a few goals. One was the agency would move forward with a report to look at the sources of the PFAS that are coming into these systems, whether it's a wastewater plant or a landfill, then pull together the stakeholder group that you've talked about. We've had four meetings on that. We've met as a group and have asked them to help develop that request for proposal to be able to put together that report. And then the final piece of that the legislation has the agency pulling together then recommendations and educational tools to help really the wastewater treatment plants on how to look upstream and do source reductions so PFAS is not coming into their systems. So those efforts are ongoing. There are other efforts that the legislature helped fund last year, too, that are ongoing. That includes a study of PFAS and biosolids and other items that are land applied that is underway. And those are two different items that will help provide information as we continue to move forward to understand how PFAS moves through the environment and also how to prevent PFAS from getting into our systems and having those costs passed on to municipal wastewater operators or landfill operators and ultimately the taxpayers.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Kudelka, Commissioner, are any of those initiatives that you're coming up with on this particular committee reflected in this bill?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the groups have not made specific recommendations or the report yet. However, the Minnesota PFAS blueprint does outline a whole chapter on pollution prevention and includes a number of items that are included in this bill, including the banning the use of PFAS in products, labeling and information about PFAS in products, so companies in that know what they're using as they move forward. So those concepts are in the Minnesota PFAS blueprint.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Okay, and I'll let me shift gears a little bit, if I can, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Kudelka. Are you aware that the EPA director has made this a priority in testing 20 PFAS chemicals currently? Are you aware of that?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, have you got a report back at all with regards to what the EPA director has been doing with that?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, EPA is collecting more information to help with creating the health-based guidance on the impacts and the toxicity of these products, various PFAS chemicals. In Minnesota, we have been a groundbreaker in this area because of our strong Department of Health and had some of the first health-based values set by the Department of Health. And they're continuing to look at the research. PFAS is one of the most researched chemicals in the world now, and they're incorporating that into the values being created here in Minnesota. And EPA is looking to do a similar work on a national level. In Minnesota here, we have health-based values for a number more PFAS than what EPA has. And so they're looking to catch up and learn more.
Mr. Chair, and I'm all finished. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Kudelka. Just really two real quick questions here is, as far as phasing out, have you got any, is there any plans at all over the next 2 or 3 years which would phase out helping the consumers as well as the producers? And if you're waiting for that information and we're already studying that at the EPA, aren't we kind of jumping ahead here a little bit? PFAS in cosmetics, PFAS in cookware I see in the bill. Shouldn't we be waiting until some of those reports come in before we move on with some of these bills that will be, if accepted, will be put into law?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we already know a number of PFAS are toxic, and there are direct impacts to humans and why we have health-based values set for a number of them in Minnesota. We also are seeing it in Minnesota fish and have health advisories based on PFAS present in fish and see bodies of water impaired. So we have that information to start as a base to start making and the foundation of why we should move forward on removing PFAS from our systems, whether it's in the products we use, the processes at manufacturing facilities or other types of locations. So the information that EPA is gathering will help us add to that knowledge. There are over 5,000 PFAS chemicals, and so that will just help us work on additional ones as they move forward. As previously mentioned, newer generations of chemicals we need to have some more information on. So we are looking here to not only continue to research the toxicity of newer PFAS, but for those that we know there's toxicities moving forward with, as I mentioned in the Minnesota PFAS blueprint, removing it for non-essential uses, such as the bills that have been introduced and in the House bill, our source reduction efforts that the legislature helped fund is really looking then at, instead of consumer products, how they're used in facilities and that may be ways to reduce them, for instance, cleaning companies. And the governor's bill has $2 million for community grants those dollars could go to facilities to help them start finding those alternatives, start piloting some of these areas to get out ahead of it before they potentially, you know, would have to address the negative impacts that their usage are creating.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for the indulgence, and thank you to the MPCA for being on the forefront on this. I mean, there's no question about that. If you know where some of this dangerous chemical is, you would, it's understandable that you would move forward. It just seems like we got to be very cautious, however, that it doesn't just throw a wrench into the whole production and consumption portion of our society. And with that, I think I'll just thank you for your testimony and Mr. Chair, and that's it for me right now.
Thank you. Commissioner Kudelka, is there any naturally occurring PFAS?
Mr. Chair and committee members, no.
Commissioner Kudelka, when was PFAS, the first PFAS, produced and introduced into commerce?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the 1940s and 1950s is when we knew of the materials being made here in Minnesota at the 3M facility.
Commissioner Kudelka, do we all have PFAS in us around the world?
Mr. Chair and committee members, PFAS is found in humans in various locations, even those that do not live or drink water next to contaminated sites.
And Commissioner Kudelka, the state of Minnesota, after trying to work on this for many years, actually had to take manufacturers to court. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. We did take 3M to court for a number of cleanups and continuing to work on other efforts too.
So this wasn't resolved with a cup of coffee and a discussion. We had to take them to court. We have to still have to deal with court on making sure that they follow the court decision. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, in the past, we have had to do that, correct.
And are you still having to enforce the decision? Are there disagreements about the decision?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're continuing to work on the 2007 consent order and the settlement, and they are working forward on that, and we're continuing to work with them on other items also.
Commissioner Kudelka, if a homeowner or a resident or apartment dweller or a city gets PFAS into their drinking water, how do you remove it?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we would have to install some type of treatment system, either granular activated carbon or ion exchange, that would add cost to those entities.
And how much would that cost for a city drinking water system?
Mr. Chair and committee members, you know, we've installed temporary systems for $2-3 million for a well to build a system in, and then there's ongoing operation and maintenance costs. For a whole home system, it's $2,500 to install one, and then operating costs average about $1,000 a year.
So members, you know, the saying used to be prevention is cheaper than cleanup, but prevention is actually better than cleanup because, as was mentioned earlier, the cost keeps rising from these forever chemicals. This is a cost that's going to be forever there. It would seem that ski wax, PFAS and ski wax is not an essential item for Minnesotans or Americans, that we could find some agreement. I think we heard from Representative Heinzman and Representative Wasilek, Senator Ingebrigtsen, you know, can we at least find some common ground here on looking at prevention with one or more items or some additional, because the cost is going to vex us forever. I think Commissioner Kudelka, have we spent bonding money, general fund, taxpayer dollars for Bemidji and other places that have had PFAS contamination?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. We've spent general fund bonding dollars along with remediation fund, closed landfill investment dollars, and other dollars to address tens of millions of dollars in cleanups costs so far.
And if the DNR is here, I know there was a study in Michigan about PFAS and deer, and I believe that Minnesota was attempting to replicate that study for wildlife with deer. Is Commissioner Meyer on, where he could maybe give us an update on that? Maybe he is not. Commissioner Kudelka, are you aware of that study?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I would have to get back to you on the details of it, but you're correct. We are looking. There have been two rounds of looking at PFAS and deer in the East Metro, up in the Duluth area and another location. And we're also looking at starting work to move forward with a study on waterfowl.
If we could maybe get updates on those, Commissioner Kudelka, and I apologize, the DNR was not on the link, so that is not their absence is not their fault. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen, just on the PFAS, it would seem we could work on this. I would hope there's a lot of menu of options here. It seems that Representative Wasowick and Representative Heinzman want to work on it. Any thoughts you have on that?
I'm certainly open to looking at some things. I need some more input from my members before I'm settled on moving forward with anything, especially in light of the legislation we passed last year with the study group. I mean, I think it's a little bit putting the cart in front of the horse if we don't wait until we at least have that. And I mean, that's what we spend these dollars on for studies, and it sounds like they're at least meeting and moving forward, but it's got a little ways to go. But I'll certainly have good discussions with my members, Mr. Chair.
Good. Maybe are we done with PFAS, members, for today? I want to bring up on page, it's R56, and this has been on for several years, section 8, line 27.9. And I think this was a Representative Morrison provision. If she can maybe highlight the medical rationale on chlorpyrifos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I was going to weigh in briefly on the PFAS conversation as well. Chlorpyrifos is a little bit like PFAS and some of the other things we've been talking about this afternoon, and that as we learn more, we have to adapt and change. And we've learned, you know, I've been in the legislature for almost 3.5 years now, and we've been talking about PFAS since I got there. And we have a lot of circular conversations about process. We know these are forever chemicals. We know a lot about their danger and their ubiquitousness. It confounds me why we wouldn't be doing more to stop putting them into the environment. Chlorpyrifos, similarly, we've known for a long time about its neurotoxicity. Developing fetuses, infants, and young children seems particularly susceptible to the adverse impacts of exposure to chlorpyrifos. It's been banned in many countries. It was banned for household use in the United States and Canada in 2001, and yet we continue in many areas to use it on our agricultural lands. So, and again, you know, in talking about issues of environmental justice and disproportionate impacts, people who work in farming communities and agricultural areas that use chlorpyrifos have been found to have children who have higher rates of persistent developmental disorders, ADHD, and other neurologic deficits that are have been linked to chlorpyrifos. So the American Academy of Pediatricians came out with a really strong statement after the Trump administration rescinded the Obama administration's plan to ban chlorpyrifos. This national organization of physicians who take care of infants and young children was horrified because the science is very clear about the dangers of it to children. So those are the reasons for the impetus for banning its use in Minnesota, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Morrison, while you were talking, we were trying to get Commissioner Meyer on the PFAS. So We may be having some technical difficulties there. Your provision is not related to agriculture, but is for public lands. Is that correct? So it's lands that the people of Minnesota own?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair, maybe the representative can help me here with understanding where this comes from and where it's used. Is it also used on, or am I confused with fertilizer for agricultural cropland?
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, it is not a fertilizer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I was told yesterday by a fertilizer company that there's a coating on the fertilizer that has a substance that's pertaining to one of the articles in the bill, and I'm not sure if this is it or if it's something else, but it's a little coating that goes around the little bead of fertilizer.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that's a different section. So this is like bug spray on, you know,
okay,
in state parks, WMAs, etc. They're
sure. Yeah, that's what it said. Okay, thank you.
Wildlife. So this is on. It says a pesticide, not a fertilizer, using an insecticide on a WMA, state park, state forest, aquatic management area, or scientific and natural area. So. There are seed treatments on some of that, but usually you're not planting corn on a scientific and natural area. Representative Morrison?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I have anything to add. I think you cleared that up, and I'm seeing Assistant Commissioner Meyer has just arrived.
Oh. So Commissioner Meyer, welcome, and sorry for kind of surprising you with this. We were talking about the PFAS study for deer, and just wanted to, and Commissioner Kadelka had referenced it but didn't have the info, and I understand you don't have the info at your fingertips, but maybe just describing that. And then we were on the pesticides on state lands provision as well. So Commissioner Meyer, welcome to the committee, and sorry for the surprise.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the invitation, and thank you, everybody. As far as the PFAS sampling in the deer, we sought samples for testing throughout the state at locations of known contaminations, fire foam, things like that, Duluth, Lake Elmo, other places. We didn't obtain as many samples as we've sought, so we're going to try to do that again this year. And it is, as you would suspect, it is showing up in the tissue of deer in certain areas of the state. I can certainly get those locations and that information for you. So, you know, it's in us. It's everywhere, right? So you find it in the polar caps. So it wasn't a big surprise to us to find that, but I will get you more information on the locations as far as that. And then, Mr. Chairman, you were talking about chemical use on WMAs on state lands, I believe.
That's correct. And I think we've discussed this before, maybe just the DNR policy on both chlorpyrifos and neonicotinoids on state lands, WMAs, state parks, state forest, AMAs, SNAs.
Yes, and we've discussed this in your committee with your members, as you're well aware. We do not allow the use of those products on state lands. And actually, when you look at forestry, the forested lands or our forestry department lands, we are dual certified by certification experts that monitor and review all of our forest management practices. And there are requirements or restrictions on the use of some of those products that we follow and make sure people understand as well. So those are just some of our practices that we use.
So putting those procedures and practices into statute would help enshrine them for the future.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did support these proposals in your committee, as you're aware, and we appreciate Representative Morrison and your support for these issues.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Meyer, So you're not doing this now. Has that been accomplished by way of rule then?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, we approach these things several different ways. A commissioner's order is one method that we use, most common method. And then our forest certification, that's, I believe it's by a commission order, but it's just operational procedure that we cannot do that and have our land certified still, which is important for industry purposes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, explain to me the importance then of putting it in statute if you're already doing it.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
Members, the one thing that statute would provide would be a permanent place for people to understand these issues. Currently, right now, they're done by a commissioner's order, which aren't the easiest thing to research. Legislation, you can go to the legislative website, you can find it, people know where the statutes are, know the numbers. It would provide that security, also that it wouldn't be changed. Not that I would ever see a different commissioner wanting to change it, but commissioner's orders can be changed. There's a process to do that. I think we do these practices for a number of different reasons. Health and protection of our lands, of species that are there, and in the case of forestry, for economic purposes, making sure that our lands remain certified so that buyers of that timber expect those timber, that those trees to be grown sustainably. So that's a big part of that piece right there.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And final question on this issue. So you're saying that it wouldn't be, it could possibly change with a different commissioner. You don't think it would. I probably believe that. I don't think it probably would either. So is it easier to change with regards to rules, or is it easier to change the statute? Should it not be needed any longer 20, 30 years down the line?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think it's easier to change via commissioner's order, but there is more permanence in the statute. So obviously we know it's not easy to change statute. It's easy, it can be done. It takes a long process, and it takes a lot of support from different groups, the House, the Senate, the governor, where a commissioner's order could be changed just by a commissioner. So statute is a more secure, permanent way to proceed, if that's a concern from people.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation, Commissioner Meyer. I just wanted to add and remind that former President Trump overturned the planned ban on chlorpyrifos, so having it in statute provides an extra layer of protection from a similar situation.
I think Representative Morrison is citing that having a good practice protected from politics is something we can agree on in statute is a good thing.
I got one more question with regards to that. Mr. Meyer, are the ag folks now enforcing this?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we are enforcing this upon ourselves on state lands. There is no Department of Agriculture enforcement on DNR operated lands. That's the question you're asking.
So I guess my whole point is that if the ag community is still continuing to do this without any restriction, it's really kind of a stab in the dark here. And I'm not disagreeing with it. I'm just saying if the ag community is still utilizing this without any restriction, I just wonder how much good it'll do. But thanks again.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. I think particularly with the chlorpyrifos on public lands, where the public is there, there's a greater opportunity for exposure on the public lands than maybe in the fields. And so particularly as Representative Morrison referenced, with that exposure, particularly with kids, I mean, we got people in parks and that. So I think the chlorpyrifos particularly is something where it has a, it may be different than conventional agricultural use in terms of exposure with regular people, just being there who aren't involved with the protective clothing that's needed for either the gloves or whatever, who are handling the material. So members, are there any other questions for PCA or tourism? Again, I regret we were not able to get Met Council here. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think we have till 4 o'clock, but I think we've had good discussions this afternoon. I don't know if you're still in session today or if the Senate has adjourned, but you would have the gavel tomorrow.
Well, Mr. Chair, we are not any longer in session. Being we've got the DNR commissioner here, maybe we should talk a little more about CWD that's in this bill, knowing that a huge portion of the similar languages in the bill, in the ag bill. I have some concerns about that. I don't know if anybody wants to talk about any of that stuff. If you want to do that at a later time, I'm fine. Unless there's something else that anybody else wants to talk about. I mean, we've got a lot of issues in here that we certainly have not got on the Senate side, so.
I'm open to that. Maybe we could have Ms. Taylor and Mr. Hagemeyer walk through the policy and the appropriations, and then have Commissioner Meyer maybe talk that, because I think we should have that discussion on chronic wasting disease. It's a critical issue. So, Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, the CWD-related provisions, I'm assuming, would be just the farm survey provisions that the House is carrying, and those are in Article 3, which you can find at the bottom of R106. I can go through the sections just real briefly here. Section 1 makes the location data for survey farms public. Section 2 on R107 has some provisions related to escape survey. Section 3 on the top of R108 has some new fencing requirements. Section 4 has some fencing requirements specific for farmed white-tailed deer. Section 5 has some new identification requirements for white-tailed deer. Section 6 on R109 would prohibit new white-tailed deer farm registrations with some exceptions for family transfers. Section 7 has a number of new requirements that would apply for owners when there's a CWD infection. Section 8 on 110 has some new importation restrictions. Section 9, starting on R111, would require the live testing of white-tailed deer. And then sections 10 and 11, transfer authority from the Board of Animal Health to the DNR. And that concludes those. And then I don't know if you want Mr. Hagemeyer to go through the appropriations.
Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, on Article 1 of the side-by-side, looking on page R14 on the House side, line number 12.3, there's $1.383 million added to the base in FY25. That would be for the transition for the duties from the Board of Animal Health to the Department of Natural Resources. If you go down further, you'll see on R15, on line 14.8, there's $250,000 for the RT quick testing for the DNR to have a RFP for that process. And then on R16, you'll see on lines 14.15 to 14.8, there's a one-time appropriation of $500,000 for chronic wasting disease response in the city of Grand Rapids.
Commissioner Meyer. And Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chairman, there's a number of those provisions that have come out of or are directly related to the recommendations that the DNR and the Board of Animal Health presented to the legislature in our concurrent authority report. I know we spent some time going through that, but and I can provide that report to the committee as well. It has a lot of recommendations that are contained in there. One of the biggest things that we've discussed between the board, the Board of Animal Health, the DNR, and other stakeholders, and it's been discussed in the legislature too, is the movement of these animals. The reason why the DNR's movement ban had to be so restrictive, covering both in-state and interstate and intrastate movement, is because of the Commerce Clause, the Federal Commerce Clause. If we could control or limit the deer that are coming into the state from infected areas, it would greatly reduce the need to do those types of activities into the future. I do not believe we import cattle from areas of the country with bovine tuberculosis. I do not believe we import other domesticated livestock animals from other parts of the country that have known diseases or infections into the state of Minnesota. That is what we're allowing to do. The language on the importation ban that is in the House provision, and that was also in the amendment offered on the Senate that passed initially and was withdrawn, is the language that is preferred and needed to stop the ban, to stop CWD coming into the state of Minnesota. At a minimum, at a very minimum, the DNR would like to see that language pass into law. We have discussed this with the board. I believe the Board of Animal Health is supportive. There are very few white-tailed deer that are actually imported from these parts of the country at all. There are only 170 cervids total imported from parts of the country that are identified in that language. So I urge you to think about that piece of it. The rest of it, think of that as a base. The rest of it are protections we can pile on top of that to deal with the farm cervids. And the language in the House bill does that. It starts to create this defense and this pyramid of defense that we need. Fencing issues. We've identified in our report as well, over 30% of the facilities that were inspected had fencing violations. Currently in rule, these farms have up to 45 days to fix those fences, which is our first line of defense from escapees or other deer coming into the state. We would like that to be 14 days. I believe there's similar language in the bill that does some of those things. The fencing, as I spoke of, the tagging of these animals. A recommendation in the report talks about tagging the deer at 14 days of birth or sooner. The language in the House goes a little bit farther, which we support. So those are great ideas. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Hansen, if you want me to go section by section on those issues you have, but they will help in the protection of the wild deer herd from the farm deer herd. I believe they help secure the deer farming industry as a safe, biosecure farm operation. Again, I go back to the disease bovine TB. Look at what we did there to protect the cattle industry from that disease. Look at what we did to eradicate the deer herd in those areas of the state because they were potential vectors. We eliminated the deer population in northwestern Minnesota almost, Skyme area. There was probably not a deer left for a while because of that bovine tuberculosis disease and outbreak. I've been saying, and the department has been encouraging the legislature to take chronic wasting disease as seriously as the state did bovine tuberculosis. There's 500,000 deer hunters out there depending, wanting a safe wild deer herd to harvest, to recreate with, to eat, to feed their families, in the case of tribal communities, tribal nations, to feed their nations. It's a subsistence food. We support all the provisions in the House bill. We support, you know, anything that we can get done this session. So it's upon all of our shoulders to get something done this year to protect the wild deer herd. And I just ask for your support.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, just to the, you know, some of these provisions you've seen before in conference committee, some of them even go back to 3 years ago when we did find compromise and common ground on some things. And they didn't halt, what we did 3 years ago did not halt the spread. And now we have it in the Pines, we have that in Grand Rapids. And so the reason it's in both the Ag Bill and here is I think that demonstrates the House wants something done, that Chair Sundin and I, as the Ag Chair and as the Environment Chair, together want something done. We need something done. And we've tried. Think of what would have happened if we'd had double fencing 3 years ago when we got double gates. And we gave people time to put in the double gates, and some of them still didn't put in the double gates. They resisted. Some of them, you know, if we had this same issue, you know, where there's just resistance to doing things, maybe we wouldn't have the spread. Look at what we're doing right now with high path avian influenza. Our poultry producers, whether they are turkey or chicken, are not resisting. They're working with the state and federal agencies because they understand the difference. So we have been trying, and yes, we've been throwing all these things up year after year after year, and we run into resistance. And I think there's things we can do. I'm asking you and actually pleading with you, let's find some common ground here. Some of these things don't require any money, but they would have an impact. I'm pleased to have the DNR say that they would support these initiatives because we need to get something done. Our wild deer herd is at risk. And I would like, and maybe this is something for a future meeting, maybe to have Peter Larson come in to talk about the latest science, because I think they keep finding out more and more science to get some of that research that we've been promoting and funding. Last thing I saw is now more evidence that CWD can be transmitted to humans. So it becomes not just a wild deer herd issue, but a public health issue. And look what we've done with these other things, whether it was bovine TB or high path avian influenza. We've taken action. So I'm asking that we try to work on this and try to get something done. And I know we're not going to agree. I know there's resistance. I know there's challenges with it. But hopefully we could find some common ground on this. And I reach out my hand virtually to try to see how we can do here, Senator Ingebrigtsen. We were able to do that 3 years ago, and I think we could do it again.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, you know, obviously we want to eradicate it. We want to get rid of it. We all know what deer hunting is to Minnesota and what a tradition it is and has been. But Section 35, if I might, is primarily agricultural, and I'm just wondering if we're going to be wasting our time here. Maybe Mr. Meyer can Commissioner Meyer can tell me what's going on in the ag community as far as the ag bill when it comes to farm survey. And has there been any talk of a buyout? Or I know that's been certainly on the agenda. And Commissioner, I don't know if you're qualified to answer or not with regards to consumption of CWD and what the outcome of that is for humans. I'm not real terribly familiar with that, but I know Wisconsin's herd over there is totally infected, or at least the southwest part of the state of Minnesota or state of Wisconsin, and I don't think they're just leaving their deer lay when they shoot them. I'm sure they're consuming them as well. So can you give me some more comments on that? And just, it's not that I don't agree with something has to be done, Representative Hansen. It's that whether we're going to be doing it or whether it belongs in the farming statutes you know, we could tie up an awful lot of time with this when we should be dealing with other things.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Ingebrigtsen, thank you for that. We have spent a substantial amount of time in the Senate and the House Ag Committees talking about this issue. And just to take one step back, and it would be perhaps Ben Stanley or other legal counsel could verify this statement, but I believe it is a part of this conference committee, D DNR does have authority under Chapter 35, so Chapter 35 is part of your committees, the way I view it. But with that being said, the Senate Ag Bill has $1 million to give to deer farmers for impacts that have occurred, that they testified of revenue losses because of our stop movement orders to protect the wild deer herd. There's also some language in there that would that the DNR testified not in favor of in Senator Westrum's committee that would say that the concurrent authority is dependent on one agency has to approve the other agency's actions for that to occur, for them to do that, basically, in a nutshell. That is concerning to us for several reasons. The board is actual board. It's not an entity. They are not a direct part of the administration. So then now we're allowing a board to dictate the DNR's activities, possibly. And our main role, our main goal is to get the concurrent authority up and running. We're almost to the point to finalize our MOU. In fact, we have a meeting on Thursday to go through some of those things. There's just a few administrative pieces we need to finalize, and then we will be solidifying those positions on who's going to do what into the future. So we look forward to doing that as well. But the Senate bill beyond the $1 million to the deer farmers for deer farmer relief and those changes to concurrent authority has no other additional CWD or farm survey language in the bill, at least the Senate side. The House side has provisions that are similar to what is in this bill, and actually they go a little bit farther, I believe, in a couple of the provisions that are on the House Ag bill in that conference committee.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I'm not, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly not of legal mind. Maybe Mr. Stanley can help me, but or Commissioner, is this something, this issue that's been lingering and going on and on and on here? I know we've come from roughly, I'm just taking a stab at this, 500 to 600 farms down to 100 and some farms now over the last years. I think folks are seeing the writing on the wall that they're not too well received, apparently. Well, that's pretty obvious. What I'm wondering, and we brought this up before, is that due to the nature of, it being a kind of a different situation here, when you talk about agriculture and you talk about wildlife, we pursue the animal out there, and the DNR has a lot to do with that. They set programs, they set the limits, they set the seasons. And obviously a whole bunch of people care about that. I mean, traditionally it's been a thing in my family for years and will continue, I hope. But then you have the ag community where apparently somewhere down the line or years ago, this was an agricultural issue because they were considered deer farms. And I think under statute are still considered deer farms. So I'm wondering, if it's something that the administration can do without the legislature. I think it's almost come to the point where somebody else is going to have to step in, and if the governor has the authority to do that, I don't know. I don't know if he has the authority to do that without the legislative approval. I know we all worry about us making the decisions for the governor, and we should do that, not for the governor, but should vet all that and send it to him. But it just seems like we're spinning our wheels here, and I'm wondering if Commissioner, if you know if the governor has the authority to step in and basically stop cervid farming in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. I believe when we were talking about the governor's authority, it was related to reorganizing the Board of Animal Health or transferring their responsibilities for cervid oversight to the Department of Natural Resources. The concurrent authority language passed into law last year, I think, has dealt with that issue sufficiently, at least at that level. Obviously, there's language in this bill that would transfer the program completely to the DNR that I spoke to earlier. I don't know. The Board of Animal Health, the board itself, would have to take some action, I think, to do something to direct the board to do that. The governor doesn't have any direct control over the Board of Animal Health. It's similar to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Director Jashke is appointed by the board, not by the governor. He serves at the pleasure of the board, not the governor directly, right? So I think that's one of the issues we have there. The other one, and you correctly stated it, is that we don't have another farm animal that is a wild animal and also classified as livestock by statute. So therein, I think, lies one of our problems. The DNR is given the authority to manage the wild deer population, whereas under statute up until last year, the Board of Animal Health had that authority for the livestock, for the farmed servants. Now that we have the concurrent authority, we're managing them together. And I think we will be able to work with the deer farmers to come up with methods and enforcement and inspections that enhance the ability to protect the wild deer herd as well. So I know that's not a direct answer to your questions, but those are just some of the issues that come to mind when you bring those points up, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll end with this. I'll do some research before tomorrow's meeting. And due to the fact that the governor appoints the Board of Animal Health, I believe he does strictly the appointments. My guess is that he's got an awful lot more authority than what you're stating here with regards to the Board of Animal Health coming up with a resolution here. So whether the governor uses the board that he selects to make that decision or he makes it himself, but I'll double check on that and get back to the committee tomorrow. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner Meyer, as you were talking about livestock and the wild herd of cervid versus farm, would turkeys fall into that category that you said maybe wouldn't be an example of there being other wildlife versus domestically farmed animals? Just out of curiosity, I do have other more important questions, but I'm just curious on that one.
Mr. Chairman, no, the farm turkeys are domesticated, obviously. They're white. The wild turkeys that we manage are of a different strain. So there's a domesticated, and that's a great example. There's domesticated strains of turkeys and there's wild turkeys. We don't have a domesticated strain of deer that are in the farms. They're still the same deer. So I hope that provides some clarification on that issue.
Representative Heintzman.
No, I appreciate that. I thought genetically they were the same animal, but it's just a curiosity. What I was more interested in, though, Assistant Commissioner, was, you know, we've been talking about this for a long time, this issue of cervid farms. And I do want to just get a clarification, you know, under some of the issues that we've been discussing relative to, I believe, to be violations of the law. Are there fines for non-compliance for these deer farms under current statute? Because I believe there is, and I just would like that for this conversation and for the public record to be confirmed.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heintzman, there are penalties, and I don't have those with me in front of me directly right now, but I will send you the fee schedule of what those penalties would be. They're actually all derived from the board that would do that right now. And it's one of the things in our MOU we're looking at as well. But I'll get you that information. We'll send it to the committee here shortly.
Representative Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, and I think it's important to point out that there certainly are. And if they're not substantial enough, you know, maybe that's something that we could be looking at as opposed to some of the regulation that we're seeing proposed in the House language again. I think, again, this is, I'm being redundant, but we need to be all working together on this. And sometimes, like in the other issue, the PFAS issue, we're going so far extreme in one direction. And maybe as Representative Wasilek had suggested, it was a bit of a tactic to come into conference committee and take a more extreme position. But I would think it'd be more productive if we could look at this in a way that both sides right out of the gate recognize as an issue. And I brought forward legislation this session that unfortunately didn't go very far in the House that would have done a buyout preemptively rather than the federal indemnity that's a current option. And this would, I think, have provided an option going forward. But for some reason, it wasn't successful in the House. And I'm just wondering, I know Assistant Commissioner Meyer, you heard that language. What was DNR's thoughts, if there was anything you wanted to offer relative to the hearing that we did have in the Ag Committee on my bill? Was there something there? Is there anything that we should be talking about? Because it feels like there was resistance from Democrats to actually move that forward through the process. Did DNR have a position?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
Representative Heinzman, we've been talking about that, not only internally, but with other stakeholders. We haven't come to let's do it. It should be this much. I mean, I think the issues are the value per animal. What happens to those facilities afterwards? Can they bring in, if they buy out the deer, would they be able to bring in elk, for example, buffalo, not have any more cervids on that property? What happens to the fence? Some of those things. We wouldn't want to be buying out people who are not in current registration, or their registration isn't in a positive or affirmative status. So all of those things need to be discussed. And then, of course, obviously, we would never want to use game and fish fund dollars to do that. So it would need to be a general fund source. We haven't, the DNR hasn't gotten that far, whether we should buy these animals out or not. We have discussed it. There have been examples in the past where certain industries related to natural resources, commercial netting, for example, on several of our bigger lakes, we have bought out those businesses. So there is a precedent that shows that. As far as the nuts and bolts, yes or no, we haven't gotten that far as an administration, as a DNR, I should say. And I do not believe the board or the Department of Agriculture have had any in-depth conversations, but you would have to check with them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, maybe the question I should be asking is, you know, if we haven't got the nuts and bolts figured out as you were suggesting, Assistant Commissioner, maybe is it possible a DNR working group could be formed? Could the commissioner do that to try and get some of these issues worked out so we can come, you know, we can go a little further down the road if that's the direction that we should be taking? It's just such a divisive issue, it seems. And I feel like there should be something productive. A lot of the language that we heard in the Environment Committee this session, and I know that you were up attending those hearings, Assistant Commissioner. So a lot of it was very much regulatory. And the deer farmers felt like it was purposefully working towards making the industry so bringing the regulatory climate to a point where it would literally be putting people out of business, you know, as opposed to, here again, the stick approach. Maybe a working group could come up with some ideas to try to incentivize people into a different business model versus the potential of seeing bankruptcy in the future for a lot of these groups. And if you could maybe let us know if a working group is an option or not, that'd be helpful. What are your thoughts?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heinzman, thank you. Those are great comments. Working groups are always an option, right? We've been working with the CWD Action Coalition, who advanced this item previously. Actually, we have another meeting with them tomorrow just to update them on where things are at and talk about what we're talking about right now. What do we want to see done in this conference committee? What should we see done? So that's a positive step forward, but talking about that, how do we do it? And we certainly can continue those conversations if people think it would be fruitful or productive. And I just want to state for the record, the DNR's position is not to shut down the deer farms. It's to make sure that they're being enforced and regulated to protect the wild deer herd. Fair and simple. And that's what we're doing together with the Board of Animal Health to doing everything we can. We do need more tools. We need resources and we need support. And I appreciate both bodies having those conversations and willing to work together with us to come up with solutions. I mean, that's what, in my world, democracy means, right? It's all working together for the better good. Let's put our heads together and see what we can do in the next 12 days on this issue. I would appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, that was super helpful. I think that us putting our heads together in the next 12 days is a great suggestion. At the same time, I do feel like we're missing, and you said it maybe best, the nuts and bolts, the framework to really move this. And I think DNR is well equipped to facilitate that kind of conversation, because I was proposing some ideas. It fell to the wayside. It wasn't supported. I think that a lot of what we're seeing in the House language will likely fall to the wayside because it's so extreme and so regulatory heavy. And I don't think that it's really workable. So, you know, and I do need to point out that deer farms are allowed under current law. That is where we are today. And so that's why, just to start the conversation, at least I was attempting to in the House, proposed a buyout. And that language, of course, included provisions that would have said, okay, no longer is this facility going to be a deer farm. Now, you brought up a good point, Commissioner. Maybe it could have transitioned into an elk farm, and maybe that's not the best way to go. But, you know, without that feedback, without the bills moving through the process and getting that feedback, we don't really wind up with anything except what we have here today, which I don't know that this is going to be the regulatory language that we have here is going to be workable, because it literally is going to put these deer farms in a position where they're facing, and they told us this, bankruptcy. So a buyout seems to be the direction that we should more seriously be considering. How to pay for it, that's a question. What you should do with the land going forward, that's a question. But we're not going to get those answers, probably not anyway that I can tell, you know, in the next 12 days. It was something maybe that we could have started talking about back in February, March, but we're in the final moments of this session. So I would suggest going forward that the commissioner seriously consider getting us some of that nuts and bolts to help advise the legislature as to what would be workable and that would help these deer farmers transition into a business model that different business model and keep them out of bankruptcy. So I appreciate the testimony today, but I do think that we're going to need to be talking about this more going forward. I think we're missing some opportunities this last 5 months, and maybe going forward we'll have a better shot.
It's Representative Heisman, it's kind of stunning that this issue has been out here for years. The legislative auditor did a report in 2018 that was ignored by the Board of Animal Health. Ignored. Every time, every piece of legislation has been resisted by the deer farming community. Every piece for years. Suddenly, now when we have CWD around the state, including up in the pine trees, after we had an extensive dumping where the state had to pay over $200,000 to build a fence. Suddenly, we need to reach for the public pocket to pay people to do the right thing. Throughout this, we have a theme of where the public has to pay to clean up the mess. The public always is asked to clean up the mess, whether it's a chemical contaminant or now with a biological contaminant. Why is it that we always have to have the public pay to clean up the mess? Commissioner Meyer referenced multiple violations when there's dual inspection. Some of those may not have been found before. So that dual inspection found those things and they came with recommendations. So we've had groups meeting. The other Minnesota solution is always kick it to a task force of lobbyists to come back. We are elected to make decisions and we've been trying to do that. Again, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the things that were referred to as radical that are in the bill are things like having identifying ear tags. So when Minnesota hunters, which are in the DNR's jurisdiction, when Minnesota hunters shoot a deer that has an ear tag, which happens, deer aren't born with ear tags, that the ear tag identifies who owns the deer. Is that shutting down deer farms to have an identifier? Is that radical to have an identifier on the ear tag so that when somebody shoots a deer during hunting season, that they can identify who it belongs to? I think not. Everything that's proposed is referred to as radical or extreme. What's radical is that this disease has been allowed to spread and we've tried to make some changes. And again, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I applaud the work we did 3 years ago. I think there is common ground without reaching into the public purse, without punting it after 5 years to another group of lobbyists to figure out what to do and delay another year. We have spent, I believe, $20 million of public money reacting to this. And we shouldn't have to spend any more. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do believe that the deer are tagged. And am I not correct? Or are we just changing the age of the tagging here, dropping it down to a earlier age? Is that correct? Is that what the bill does?
That is one provision. The others have clearly identified who it belongs to, because right, you may have a number on it where the owner knows that number. You're familiar with your tags.
Yeah.
So to have an identifier that says this deer belongs to Rick Hansen or Bill Ingebrigtsen, so if somebody sees it, they know where to go.
Well, my final comments are this. Chair Hansen, you just mentioned that the legislative auditor did an audit most recently, and all the weight and all the heavy came down on the Board of Animal Health. Well, again, that's why I think that what I'm going to, well, I know what I'm going to do between now and tomorrow's meeting. I'm going to come up with some kind of information as to what the administration can actually step in and do. Again, now, the Board of Animal Health if I think I'm not speaking out of church, the Board of Animal Health is appointed by the governor, and if the Board of Animal Health is told to do something and they're an arm of the governor, then you know he needs to look at that. He needs to look a little stronger, possibly. I've never heard any discussion come out of the administration's office with regards to this issue. So I'm not so sure the governor's taking it as serious as you and I have, and the commissioners as well, and as well as the Board of Animal Health. And if there's something there that can be done, we could be done real quickly here if he really cares about this. And it's not just you and I. I mean, we've got to convince other House members as well as Senate members to to do the legislation that's before us right now. But I think in one fell swoop, I think the governor could do this. So, and I'm not in the blame game here, but it just seems like we are at a stalemate. And Representative Heintzman just said that. I mean, we've been spinning our wheels here, and we've been gathering up a little bit here and a little bit there, and we're just not getting it done. So I'll look into that, and leave it at that for now. But again, thank Commissioner for being here.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Dr. Peter Larson was listening and actually has now logged on. So we have Dr. Larson on, who could maybe reference some of the most recent research, and I believe this would be appropriate testimony as we had referenced him earlier. So if that's okay.
That's
yeah. I don't know if we've got him on camera, but
I'm here.
Dr. Larson. We were talking about the most recent research and jumping to humans a bit. So if you could maybe introduce yourself for the record, and I apologize for the short notice and not planning to have you on, but thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Chair Hansen, members of the committee, my name is Peter Larson. I am assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm co-director of the Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach, or MINPRO. I have jumped on late here, as Chair Hansen indicated, but regarding chronic wasting disease and the potential threat to human health, this is a delicate issue, and it's an issue where scientists, including myself, are becoming more and more concerned based on the data that we're seeing that's coming out. The research that's coming out on CWD prions. And most recently, there was a paper that was published out of Canada. Chronic waste disease is really bad up in Canada, just like it is in portions here in the US. There's an excellent research team up in Canada looking at CWD. They generated data indicating that the CWD prions that are common in the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin, including here in Minnesota, there is potential, and again, this research that they worked on involved rodents, so not humans, but rodents. Rodents that had a human prion gene inserted into the rodent genome, okay? So their scientists call this design a humanized rodent model. They showed that the prion strains that were circulating in the upper Midwest have potential to cause the human prion to misfold in the rodent model. Okay, that's concerning in that their data showed that the form, the shape of that prion in their research, right, was able to cause the human prion to misfold in the rodent model. There's still a stretch there, right? Does that mean that does that mean there's a clear threat? No, but what it does is it says this is a concern, because the more exposure, right, the more exposure that humans have to CWD prions, it is possible that we could see an instance where a human could develop a neurogenic disease. And that just has to do completely with exposure. So if we can eliminate or reduce prions from entering the food supply, right, with advanced surveillance methods that we can have to help prevent it, then we don't need to get to that point and worry about neurogenic disease spilling over into humans from CWD. So this is why we have to do better on surveillance and diagnostics and prevent it from getting into the human food supply.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Doctor, for being here on no notice. That's wonderful, but I really support the research that you've been doing there. You and I had a conversation not too long ago as to what gains have been made there since we appropriated the money to the university, and it's somewhat, well, it's intriguing to me. It's certainly amazing the work you're doing, and I'm wondering where we're at with testing now, and is, I know that we have what's called a quick test, I believe it is. RT quick test. How accurate is that? And are we moving forward on any other type of testing for chronic wasting disease?
Chair Hansen, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and members of the committee, the RT quick test, that this is a very robust test. It's been used for about 10 to 15 years in the research community. We've been using that test now since the money was appropriated, we were able to get that test up and running. So for the last like 3 years, and we have analyzed hundreds, if not thousands of samples of CWD positive tissues and CWD negative tissues. And what we can tell you is when using tissues, that test is very accurate. It performs as good as or better than the current traditional tests. And it has the added benefit of it can be increased throughput. So right now in our MinPro research laboratory, we have equipment now, thanks in large part to the state, that we are able to now look at hundreds of samples, test hundreds of samples in our small research lab for CWD using RT-Quick in a 48-hour turnaround time. So the technology is really, it's fantastic. The USDA has completed their first round of the validation of RT-Quick for live animal testing. Our anticipation and what they've said is that it will be fully validated and available for live animal testing for CWD probably within the next like 7 months now. It should happen at the beginning of 2023. That's what we anticipate. Because the USDA is in the process of validating the test, it shouldn't be a reflection on how well the test performs. It's just a process that the USDA goes through. It just takes time, as it should. I was able to read the letter, the statement from the Deer Breeders Association that was submitted, I think, to the committee. And they did reference the fact that soil testing, right? So soil testing is a limitation with the test. I agree with that. We need more research to perfect how we can detect CB prions in soil. So they are accurate with that. But with tissues, it's very accurate and it's reproducible.
Real quickly, if I could.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just finish up. I see there's other questions. So where are you now then with, now I'm going to forget about the question because I was intensely listening to you here. You know what? Let me try and think about it. A couple of the other folks here will trigger my memory and I'll jot it down.
Absolutely.
Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we have a flexibility to go a few minutes over. So I want to make sure we get all the questions in. And Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Larson, for being here and for your tremendous work on CWD. This strikes me as we have some themes here this afternoon. You know, as we learn new things and get new information, sometimes we have to adapt and we have to change our behavior. It's not always convenient. It's not always the way we choose it. But sometimes when we're faced with new information, we have to change course. And as Representative Hansen has said many times, prevention is better than cleanup. So I'm just curious if you can remind us, Dr. Larson, of what happens to a deer that is infected with CWD, and then potentially what that might look like if this frightening new information it ends up being true that there is possible transmission to humans, and what that might that disease course look like in human beings.
Dr. Larson.
And lastly, if I can add one third question, how would you describe your urgency, your sense of urgency about containing CWD in Minnesota?
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen, Brett Morrison, members of the committee. The way that CWD impacts cervids, impacts deer, when that misfolded prion is either ingested or inhaled, when a deer is interacting, has been exposed to that misfolded prion, that causes the disease. Okay, and this is a protein that can remain infectious in the environment for a long time, right? 3, 4, 5 years, more than that, 10 years even. When that animal ingests or comes exposed to that prion, what happens is that prion goes and it goes into its GI tract, okay? And it starts interacting with other normal prions and causes them to misfold. It causes like a daisy chain to happen, like a domino effect. So it propagates, it starts misfolding, 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 it grows, grows, grows. It colonizes a nerve that innervates from the stomach essentially up to the brain of the deer. And over a period of around 2 years, it slowly expands along that nerve, and then it colonizes the brain, and then it slowly starts to kill brain cells. And so the name chronic wasting disease, it's got its name because the animal literally wastes away and dies. It's like a very accelerated form of Alzheimer's disease, sadly. It essentially kills off the brain cells over time. The animal loses its ability to fight off disease. It becomes disoriented. It does not drink. It salivates, and it literally wastes away. So that's how the name CWD, that's where it comes from, is wasting away. So that's all. Not appreciating the impact that has on wildlife, on wild service across, you know, North America, like that sort of slow death. I mean, that's horrible, right? That's horrible. So we have to do everything we can to protect our resources in Minnesota and beyond, right? The heritage of deer and elk and whatnot. Okay, humans. Again, there's no known human case, right? No known human case. So I don't want to give the false impression or any impression that right now we're aware of like humans coming, you know, getting into disease from eating CWD positive meat. The issue is scientists are predicting that if repeated exposure, right? If you have repeated exposure of misfolded prions, similar to mad cow disease, so that killed about 170 people in the UK. Some people, it took like 10 years for them to die or longer because it was a slow process, right? So from misfolded cow prions, they were able to get a neurogenic disease and die. We haven't shown that yet in CWD, but the problem is the molecule that causes disease, it can have different shapes. And it can be a certain shape in Minnesota. Maybe it's a different shape in Wisconsin. It's kind of different shapes across the U.S. So the question that we have as scientists is there a population of deer that has a certain shape of the misfolded CWD prion that actually fits well with human and can cause disease? If yes, that's very concerning. And scientists have predicted that if CWD were to impact humans, it may not look like other prion diseases. It may look like Pick's disease or pick any neurogenic disease in this sort of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's family. It may look like that and get misdiagnosed, like familial neurogenic disease. So it may have a different phenotype than what we saw with BSE. So there's a lot of unknowns there. Bottom line is, we got to prevent it from getting in the human food supply. Oh, urgency. Sorry, that's the third part. This is urgent. Like, I am not kidding you. Every day since the Minnesota legislature, you know, awarded us that original $1.8 million, I have been thinking about CWD and this problem every single day and thinking about how can we get in front of this disease, right? How can we use these resources and get in front of this disease? And so, you know, we're advancing diagnostics. We have new diagnostic tools. We have new diagnostic prototypes, thanks to the money you all invest in us, that are generating results in 3 hours using something the size of a domino. This is the functional prototype that we have, thanks to y'all, right now. Okay, so that represents the future of CWD testing, where we're going to get it fast and try to get this like deer size that hunters can eventually use. That's the goal, right? It's extremely urgent. We have to get in front of it, and we have to start looking to therapeutics. Like, I'm confident that we can solve the diagnostic problem in the coming years, Now I'm already thinking about therapeutics. How can we actually, you know, prevent or cure this disease in cervids?
Thank you, Dr. Larson and Senator Ingebrigtsen. Based on the science, I'd be willing to drop the soil testing prion provisions that are in the House language. And based on the discussion that the test will be validated in 7 months, to change the effective date so that it would accommodate the validation process so that we could use RT-QuIC to test all the captive cervids. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Larson. That was my question, is whether it would be possible to test all captive deer in Minnesota with RT-QuIC and what that testing regime might look like if that's possible.
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, Rep. Lippert. It's important to note here that Texas has already started live animal testing for CWD. They've probably been doing this over the last 2 years now, I think. What they're doing is they're taking rectal tissue, and they're testing it using traditional methods, okay? So live animal testing has already, like, we can look to Texas as an example of how this would work, because they are doing this, and they've been doing this for a while. RT-QuIC testing, it's going to use the same tissue type. The USDA is validating that rectal biopsy. That's going to be the same tissue type. Our veterinarians up here, I agree with Rep. Hansen, just indicated about the delay of trying RT-QuIC testing for live animal testing in the state. Our veterinarians, the Board of Mental Health, there's a lot of logistics that folks need to work out and figure out how to do effectively. But we can look to Texas for those answers. Yes, it is feasible to test the herds of the farm cervids in the state. However, I think we have to take a closer look at how we can be more proactive at managing the disease, right, at the farm level, right? And MinPro's position on this is if we detect it early and fast, if we detect it early, and there's like one animal out of a herd of 200, can we live test and maybe call that animal and then monitor? I struggle with, as an individual, as a scientist, one animal out of a 200 and all 200 animals are depopulated. I struggle with that, right? And I think that RT-QuIC and the latest science in CWD, if we come together and really understand how we can leverage this to actively manage and get in front of it, that's a solution that I think all of us can come around and agree on. Now, if we're too late and there's several animals in the herd and it looks like it's been there for a while, there is no option, unfortunately, right? It has to be depopulated. That's the only option, just because this molecule is so pervasive in the environment. But with testing and routine testing and monitoring, we can actually, I think, get in front of this at the farm level.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. I think you're still muted, Senator.
Muted. Yep.
I'm sorry. My first mistake all day. My goodness. So, Doctor, really quickly, to eradicate prion in the soil of an infected farm, where are we on that? Is there any substance yet that we can use to spray, or are you working and getting towards any of that type of research, which would be very, very helpful, I think, and especially in areas where we had to depopulate?
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen, Senator Ingebrigtsen, members of the committee. Yes, there are compounds that have been shown to render prions in soil non-infectious. And it's really interesting. I actually work in South Korea, where land is limited and they have CWD there transported from Canada. They've been able to look at some of these soil treatment options. The issue is that we need to figure out how to mass produce it and make it cost effective. We know that treating soil with compounds that change the pH can actually render the prions non-infectious. The problem is, if you look at any farm, you all know this, I reference this frequently. I grew up on a farm. I know what it's like in these barns, the farm landscape. That's tough. That's really tough to treat. So we have to, this is an area where we need more research on in the state, and we need cooperation and working with the servant farming community to really understand how can we effectively go in and treat a complex landscape like a farm and render these non-infectious. That's in everyone's best interest, because if you have a hot positive area, over time you have water runoff, right? We want to know where are the prions in that hot area going downstream, because they will. There's research out of Colorado showing you can detect these in water. And we are starting water research. We've started research in, you know, looking to see if we can detect prions in water. Right now, as I speak, there are folks up in Beltrami County taking water samples from the areas around the farm up there.
Yeah, we talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, this is an area that we need to really jump on. I mean, it could be a leader in the country right now, because the environmental contamination of these prions is the next biggie. But yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there are compounds that can be used to treat on farms. We need to look into that, right? Because it's in everyone's best interest from the environmental perspective, but also from the servant farmer perspective, right? Because with advanced testing, treatment, whatnot, I think we can work together to figure out some options there.
Very good.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, any more?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Representative Heinzman, and then we're probably going to have to close. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Larson, I believe I heard you say that we will have, the word was validation in 7 months. Just wanted to better understand what that means and if that 7 month timeline is a hard timeline or if that's still something that could change.
Chair Hansen,
Dr. Larson,
Rep. Heinzman, I think it was like a year ago, you asked me a similar question. I gave you a timeline, and boy, everyone was mad at me. USDA was mad at me. Board of Mental Health and DNR are mad at me. My understanding, so this is within the USDA, right? And they have procedures that just take time. And validation is a process to determine sensitivity and specificity, like how well the test performs, right? And so they're doing that. That's, I would say, you know, the 7 month, based on all the information that I've heard from the USDA that they've publicly disclosed at the Board of Mental Health meeting a few months ago, you know, we expect full validation in 7 months. What does that really mean? All that means is it as a regulatory, you know, agency, that test has to go through all these hurdles, you know, internally to make sure that it's ready. It's ready to roll out, and labs have a protocols or procedures that they can adopt across the country, right, for official testing, right? That has to happen, and it takes time. But that said, can the test be used for non-regulatory purposes? Absolutely, right? The diagnostic lab at the University of Minnesota, you know, they can't officially test for CWD using RT-QuIC until it's USDA validated. However, there's other labs, like research labs. There's one startup company that is doing RT-QuIC testing, and, you know, they're testing urine samples. There's opportunities there to sort of kick the tires on this test, right, and prepare for future expansion of RT-QuIC.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Didn't mean to get you into hot water there, Dr. Larson. Not that
my fault.
No, I think that we're all just, you know, we're excited about this. It's an important development in this subject area, in this issue, and everybody is wanting, of course, number one, the test to be accurate.
Right.
And then what are the possibilities, right? We've been asking that since way before this was even on the radar. I will go back, though, to if we could just a number of conversations, and I'm not going to be able to remember on the timeline when, but there was discussion about this being accessible and potentially transportable, field transportable, mm-hmm. and available. Is that still something that maybe not 7 months, but
is on the radar?
Dr. Larson.
Yeah, Chair Hansen, Rep. Heinzman. Absolutely. So thanks to the original investment, we were the first team. This is a big deal for the state of Minnesota. We were the first team to test for CWD using a portable, field portable test. We went down to Rushford and we did this and we had a result within 24 hours. We worked with the DNR, the USDA. So we have developed a test. It's called Minnesota Quick. So it's a derivation of RTQuick, but we named it in honor after the state to say thank you to the state for giving us the resources. So MinQuick, Minnesota Quick. Our plan is to submit that for USDA validation this summer, right? So we've been doing all the internal validations. It works really well. We're publishing it. That's going to be submitted to the USDA. So it needs to go through, right, that official pipeline. But the beauty of it is, as far as I know, we're one of the first and only teams to get to that point so that we're actually ready to submit to the USDA this test. Okay, so that's where we are on that. There's other technologies. With the original investment with the state that gave to our team, I launched four lines of independent lines of research because I did not want to come back to you in a year or 2 years or 3 years and say, all our eggs were in basket, I'm sorry. We launched four so that MinQuick was one, and that's working, right? It's working. But we have another one that's generating results in like 3 or 4 hours. That is super exciting, that uses the technology that we talked about when we originally interacted with y'all, the microfluidics nanotechnology. I am really excited about that. I think that as that goes through our internal validation, that's going to be a second one that we can get. So the thing is, thanks to the state, thanks to y'all, we've now developed multiple technologies that are going to be going through this process so that in the next like 5-10 years, we are in a position for rapid real-time CW testing, right? That's huge. That gives us so many more options. I'll say one last thing to summarize. We now have technology that we can actually swab surfaces that deer interact with, and we can test those swabs. So we can do herd-level surveillance. We're partnering with the DNR on this. We're getting interesting, like, positive results down in the surveillance down in the south eastern part of the state. So we can do like herd level surveillance in the wild, cooperating with DNR. And we have data out of Texas from a positive deer farm that we partnered with. They worked with us down there. We have results showing that we can detect herd level CWD, like 100 animals all at the same time, if you will, interacting with our sentinels and swabbing. So that's another level, right, of testing that we haven't even talked about. And so all this to say that, yes, Rep. Heintzman, thanks to your all's investment, like, we have multiple technologies, and I think that what you're going to see now in the coming years, thanks to that, is an impact at active management, right? We're going to be able to do this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Larson, your enthusiasm is coming through, and I think that all of us are probably hanging on a little bit, hoping that it's as good as what it sounds like it could be, because that opens up the door, I think, to so much more than just the scope that we're currently looking at in the language in some of these provisions. And I love how you pointed out that there's these opportunities to work with deer farmers to try and build that science out and see if you can use that technology to avoid killing the entire herd and seeing what potentially we can learn from that. There may not be another option except for indemnity and the end of that herd. That might be the only options. But if we do have technology to identify and to track that in a single herd, that's really exciting too. And then in the wild herds, as you're describing, Dr. Larson, that's just, I think, gonna further change everything we think about this and how we can conduct ourselves in our research. And I think my takeaway today from your testimony, Dr. Larson, is this problem is not going to be solved by the legislature. We could be a partner, and especially providing resources, which are taxpayer resources, but we're all working together and it affects everybody. And I think that we all agree that this is an important issue, and that we can and should be working towards developing the science. And that's going to be a game changer. This disease isn't new. It's been around for decades. And I'm glad to be a partner in that. I don't know that the regulatory tactic that is being discussed today is the solution. I think the solution is going to be in the area that you're describing, Dr. Larson. And I know that's controversial and political, but at the same time, it should be the science that is the tool that the legislature is able to use to guide our decision making. And it sounds like a lot is happening. And if in 7 months, we could potentially be seeing some big changes, just making sure that the test is as good as we think it is. That's huge. I think the argument that we need to do something now and we have to be proactive is a great line. But at the same time, I think the public and I think the folks that are tracking this issue would agree that the science is just getting there. And I hope that we're not premature in our effort. I hope that we're letting that science help us make that decision. I'm really glad you're able to get on the call today. I think that, or the Zoom, Dr. Larson, I think that your comments were super important to this conversation.
Thank you. And Dr. Larson, a couple questions. So every deer that's walking around with CWD is shedding prions, correct?
Chair Hansen, that's correct. An infected animal is shedding prions in its feces, its urine, its saliva. This is why the surveillance effort that the DNR has is so important. And this is also why it's so complicated in a farm setting. You got to catch it early to have options. If you do not catch it early, that's it. It's too late. We got to catch it early.
So wait till next year approach, or wait till 2 years or 3 years of legislative wrangling. You know, there's more prions being distributed across the landscape. The provision that I referenced in there would provide for 2 RT quick tests and then a postmortem test on a farm survey. And just going back to Representative Lippert, indicated that and asked that you could cover all farm cervids with RT quick. It would take some time. And right now, could a captive deer facility contact you and have their herd tested right now? Without
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, if a positive test by RT quick comes in, it's our responsibility to report that to the USDA, right? And so it's such a difficult, I know you all know this, but it's such a difficult issue to navigate because there's not going to be a producer out there that's going to have their herd tested, right? And then like offer up easily their herd tested, because we find positives, then that it goes down this route of depopulation. And so yes, the RT quick testing is available. We are using it. It represents the future of testing. The issue is we have to work together with the DNR, the Board of Animal Health, the science, MinPro, all together to come up with a realistic way forward, right? As far as testing the herds of the state, the farmed herds of the state, they already do this with TB testing. Every animal is being tested with or sampled, right, for TB testing. So if you kind of view a sampling regime that would sort of fit with that and that sort of, I think they do that every 3 years, but there could be a realistic, you know, the framework is already there for interacting with every single herd in the state. So if we have trained veterinarians and we have a approach that's worked out, I do think it's feasible logistically to test the farms with RTQIC. And again, Texas is already doing this at some level.
And then to your point about the resilience of the prions in the soil, after abandonment, if we have no treatment for soil, are we going to, after abandonment of a site, of a facility, whether it's in the buildings or in the, are we going to need exclusionary fencing? Can we even exclude wild deer from that or other vectors? Is it possible? What do we do with these sites? Let's say we buy them out and we have a site contaminated. What happens to that site? What's going to be required? What do we do? I mean, do we need exclusionary fencing, maintenance, operations, just the science involved with retention, resilience of the prion?
Chair Hanson, members of the committee. So right now what the Board of Mental Health does, and they would have to speak to exact methods, but there is a servant farmer whose farm has gone positive, they're responsible for cleanup. So what that means is I think like bunks and things are buried, right? They try to take everything and try to bury it. And they may bleach surfaces and whatnot. So there's some level there. The problem is, as I was saying earlier, farm environment is super complex. So we do not want to have wild deer able to access farms that have been positive. I do believe, based on the research out of Colorado and the research on scrapie and other prion disease, that positive farms do represent a multi-year threat to surrounding wild deer populations. Just from what we know about how those prions move through the environment, and then and if wild deer are coming in and able to access and be on that farm, that is a risk, yes. The problem is, where's the science, right, at with that? Like, we need access, MnPro needs access to farms that have, that were positive, to take samples and to test for prions. And so we could tell you all, like, are we finding them? And we even have ways that we can tell you if they're infectious or not, right? That needs to be done, right? So that's where we are in that realm.
And finally, we do not know the length of a prion resilience in soil. Is that correct?
Chair Hanson, members of the committee, what we know about the survivability of prions in soil, a lot of that comes from scrapie. It comes from mad cow disease or BSE. We know that scrapie prions in a barn environment, a farm environment, they can cause a prion disease 16 years after they were deposited. So if you were to take sheep that never had scrapie and put them in a farm, within a 16-year window of when that farm was positive for scrapie, they could get the disease. The research that's been done on deer in Colorado, the maximum, and this is just a limit of, I believe, the funding duration, right, that they had access funds to do this project, I believe it was like 4 years. They've shown those infectivity at 4 years, but they never tested the maximum bound, right? So you'll hear folks, you know, say 3, 4, 5 years. The reality is it is possible, based on other prion diseases, that it could be 16 years at minimum, right? Like, it could be longer. So what we know about these molecules, they can remain in the environment for a long time, and they can cause disease through environmental exposure. That research has been shown.
It's a long time to maintain an exclusionary fence.
That's right.
Representative Heinzman, and we will adjourn at 4:30. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we were talking, it occurred to me that we may have missed an opportunity, Dr. Larson. Is there anything that you and your team need right now that should be addressed? And I just wanted to give you a chance to potentially speak to that now.
Chair Hanson, Rep. Heinzman, thank you so much for offering that. I believe to maintain our MnPro Center, There is a line within LCCMR funding that would maintain our center for multi-year. It would allow us to have more graduate students, have more staff working in the lab, to really have a team focus on the environment, to focus on validating these projects. That's nestled within the LCCMR. And there is another line that is specific to soil, and that is sorely needed because this soil issue is a critical component, and we can solve that problem, but we need to have the resources to do it. And one thing I want to say to y'all, the impact that y'all are having, like with these funds, there are undergraduate students. There are undergraduate students coming through MIMPRO doing research, you know, and they're getting excited about science, and they're having an impact, right? And so the investment that y'all have made in us, we're trying to give back to the state in multiple ways, not just through the science, but also through the training, the incorporating students into the research that we do. So we're very appreciative.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, just one final comment and observation. If you need some help with that door, give me a ring.
That's my wife's door from the her farmhouse in like 1890. We just renovated it. We're going to hang it in here. It's the only thing that survived from that farmhouse. It was destroyed, and that's the only bit is that door. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heisman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was worried that it had fallen off the house, and help with that. So, all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think we're going to have to close the door on this meeting to have a pun at the end. Thank you, Dr. Larson, for appearing on very short notice. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think you're still on. You have the gavel tomorrow. With that, thank you for a very good discussion. We are adjourned.